I am at San Diego State University Library and Information Access, recording the oral histories of Dr. Carol Wayman on January the 13th, 2011, 11:05 a.m. My name is Gloria Rhodes. I am the outreach librarian at San Diego State University and conducting this interview. Good morning again, Dr. Wayman.
Thank you so much for coming here, and
I'm looking forward to listening to your story of San Diego and your presence here and the entire African-American community presence. I have a series of questions, but at any time, feel free to expound on something or go to another topic. This is just so I can make sure I cover all the bases that I'd like for the listeners to hear about your life here.
I'm glad you have me here.
And give me, or give us your name and what you do and what you, your previous jobs here in San Diego. And I know there are many of them.
Yeah, my name is Carol Wayman. That's W-A-Y-M-O-N. And I've been in San Diego since 1964. And today I'm retired after 27 years at Mesa College, and altogether about 45 years in education. That's where I am right now.
Okay. Now, when and where were you born?
I was born in South Carolina, a little town by the name of Inman, I-N-M-A-N.
I-N-M-A-N,
okay. South Carolina.
Okay.
In 1925. But I did not live there. My family moved away, so I don't know anything about that, the earlier years. Although over the years, all of us have gone back to little places where we were born.
Okay.
But that's where my family was at that time. We moved away when I was a kid. I have a twin brother by the name of Harold. I was Carol, and he was
Harold. Wow, yes.
And he died just 4 years ago.
Okay.
But when I started out, I was Walter, and he was Harold. Well, people found out in our little town that I had a middle name of Carol, so they were not about to say Harold and Walter.
Right.
So it was Harold and Carol.
Oh, okay.
So when I was in school the first semester, I was simply Walter Wayman and Harold.
Mm-hmm.
And they would not have that stuff, no.
Oh, okay.
You're Carol. So I've been Carol ever since.
All right.
We moved to Tryon, T-R-Y-O-N, North Carolina, and that's where my early references would be relevant to.
Tell me a little bit about your parents family background.
Yeah, my mother was a minister, so was my daddy.
Oh, okay.
My mother was one of the first women ordained ministers, I understand, in the North Carolina Conference, it's called. We are doing history on that now. We were doing part of it when she died She died in 10 years this year. She died at 99 and a half.
Oh, wow. So that's a long, fruitful life, I'm sure.
Yeah. We heard all our lives a story. Mother said she was going to live to be 100 years old, right from the beginning. And at 99 and a half, she decided literally that she said, well, I've lived to be 99 and a half, and I'm tired, so I'm just going to go.
Oh, wow.
Just like that.
That is amazing. What about race relations when you were growing up in North Carolina, in South Carolina?
Yeah, my little town, Tryon, North Carolina, was known as a resort for Northerners. That meant white people of that time.
Uh-huh.
So ours has never been considered one of those hard-nosed Southern towns. It was always a town where most of the people we knew were liberals or whatever you want to call it. So we had a good relationship in my little town.
Mm-hmm.
My little town was a southern town, of course. But the living patterns were different. I learned all this later. I didn't know about it growing up. The living patterns were such that blacks lived in each part of the town. We lived in the north part, the south part. We were like the rim of the town, plus other places within the town. So
mm-hmm.
there was not this rigid that we see and had to fight about housing stuff in our little town.
Oh, okay.
So race relations was good. I learned a lot about it after I got into civil rights, of course. I didn't know our little town was supposed to be an exception until I grew up. Black and white played baseball together all the time. I have a brother, for example, who was a rather excellent ball player. Mm-hmm. And he played on teams, for example, against the whites in our town. So our little town has always been considered exceptional.
Oh, good. Where is Tryon? What is the larger city?
Tryon is on the, let's see, on the west coast of North Carolina between Asheville, North Carolina,
okay,
that a lot of people know about.
Absolutely.
And going due south, straight south, I don't know the highways. Mm-hmm. Going straight south, you run into you cross the South Carolina line,
okay,
which was 17 miles from Tryon, going south. I think it was 17 miles going south, and you go into Spartanburg, South Carolina, and Greenville, South Carolina.
Okay, I know that.
In the western part
area
of North Carolina.
Okay. Any childhood memories stand out for you?
Oh, yeah, quite a number of them.
Okay, would you like to share some of them
with
us?
Yeah, a lot of memories.
Oh, wonderful. You're smiling, so there must have been good memories.
let's see. I guess one of them that stood out is our mothers and daddies teaching. I guess that's
okay.
The first thing. We didn't know anything about all the racial slurs and all this because our household was such, you don't call people names. You don't use those kind of things in this house.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is equal around the world, and one of these days, race relations that we were hearing about on the radio at that time would be all right. But ours was a moral, religious message, and in this family, this is what we do. In this household, this is what we do. This is what we believe in. All people are created equal, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So we had a whole message right from the beginning. The other is, I remember all those things.
Right.
The other is, I played basketball and baseball, and later on they called me the Michael Jordan of those years. To talk about it now,
okay.
We have a whole history there.
Uh-huh.
We're in all kind of history books in this little hometown now.
Uh-huh.
Let's see, other memories would be, I have a rather famous sister, Nina Simone,
right,
who just died a few years ago.
Uh-huh.
She died in, 03. So many of my memories revolve around not just church, but I sang and she played. I was a concert singer.
Oh, okay.
From 12 on to 18, and we went around the whole town and we sang. She sang, she played, and I sang.
She played the piano?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
But at 4 years old, she was the director of the choir, so... That's
oh
when
goodness.
She started. That's when she
so
started.
So she was a child prodigy, no
yeah,
doubt.
She, oh, yeah, she was. And that's how her whole career started. Childhood memories, baseball, basketball. Initially, when I left, though it was Tryon Colored High School, was still segregated.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, 1954, a few years after I left there, of course, it changed. And they desegregated without any difficulty. It's
oh,
one of those
okay.
little towns where they didn't have difficulty desegregating. I was the valedictorian of the class. There were only a few of us in my class.
Mm-hmm.
I remember school.
What year did you graduate from high school?
1943.
Okay.
And when I went into service in 1943 also, that same year I went into the military.
What branch?
Air Force, it was called Army Air Force at that time.
Okay.
Army Air Force. And I went many, many places. I went overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Went to Mississippi and Alabama, and not Alabama, but Texas. I went overseas.
Where overseas did you go? Do you remember?
We stopped in England and went on to France, where we were stationed in France in 1944, I guess that must have been, 43, 44, and 45. So my military was about 2.5 years. Yeah, 2.5 years. And it was not too pleasant in some parts because I have a lawsuit against the Army right now.
Really?
Yeah, they court-martialed me for disobeying direct order on the field of battle, they call it. And this is part of my history, too, because... there were only about four of us who had graduated from high school in my, or gone to college in my outfit. And they couldn't read or write. And I was the, what we call the clerk of my outfit. So I knew all the laws, and I kept the captain out of trouble. I kept the officers out of trouble. So everybody knew that I was the clerk. And what they were doing was telling some of my brothers that they couldn't get leave if their daddy or mother was dying and so forth. And I said, no, 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 this is not true. And they said, well, they won't approve our monies to get money, send it back to the states. I said, okay, here's what you do. And the officer, all it was not black and white. We all had white officers at that time. This is before 1948.
When so it wasn't a segregated unit?
Segregated unit. We had, but we didn't have any black officers in my outfit.
Okay.
All officers were white.
Okay.
But everything else was black.
Okay.
Non-commissioned officers, we call them non-com. The top kick, that's the first sergeant who runs the outfit. The Netter was his name. He was black. Mm-hmm. But he had been a professional soldier since 1930. Let's see, this was 43. Since 1938, I think it was. He had been a professional soldier. So he was schooled in the old subordinate position and so forth. And we called him an Uncle Tom at that time. So I said, I'm going to teach my brothers all about what they need to know, and I'll fill out the papers for them. And you can, we cannot deny them what to do. Mm-hmm. They said, well, you're not going to do that around here. Now, this is the first sergeant, Netter, saying, and we had all officers. And I said, well, you know, this, I quoted all the, I knew all that stuff, and I quoted all that. And I said, look, this is their right. You can't deny them their rights. So he told the captain, who was white, of course, and we have to find some way to shut him up. Well, at that time, before I left the States here, before we got on, I missed a whole chapter in there. I had been a star basketball player in my little hometown, and I sang.
And this is at Tryon High School,
yeah,
the college school?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I had been a baseball player and all that.
Okay.
So I was in special services during my first year and a half in the military.
Mm-hmm.
Special services meant we stood around and did practically nothing all day. And
okay.
It was in Texas and in Arizona. And I had taken this time to brief myself and learn all the stuff I needed to know. And I had a special condition I didn't know at that time. I was allergic. I knew I was allergic to something. But I was allergic to wool, and especially the woolen clothing. I don't know whether you know about it, the brown stuff they call for the military. All that stuff I was allergic to.
Okay.
And I didn't know I was allergic to that. I knew I was allergic to some things.
Uh-huh.
And so I developed a skin rash and went to the, I played basketball under the special services all day long while we were waiting for orders to go here and there. And I went to what we call sick leave, sick call in the mornings. And I found out that I was allergic to this stuff, so I couldn't wear it. So to make it short, they put me in the hospital. They tested my skin, and sure enough, it showed rashes, and I was allergic to that.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't wear all that stuff. They gave me some special underwear to wear because I couldn't wear all that military stuff and special stuff. So my outfit was going to leave to go overseas at that time.
Where were you stationed when this was?
Yeah, that was in Texas.
Okay, that was in Texas.
Yeah, Texas.
Okay.
We moved from Texas to to Arizona.
Okay.
But now there's several moves in between there.
Right. Okay.
In the meantime, I had tested for going to Tuskegee. I didn't know what Tuskegee was and all that then, but I soon learned. And so they put me on special leave while I tested and played basketball and sang in the choir for a long time to test me to see if I qualified to become one of the Tuskegee Airmen.
Okay.
So I qualified to go to Tuskegee. But again, because of all this crazy stuff going on, we went to Tuskegee. I had a chance to go to Tuskegee and look around.
Okay.
But I didn't go into the airman because of the difficulty I was having with my white officers.
Okay.
So this time.
But it didn't have anything to do with your skin condition.
Not at that time.
Okay.
Yeah, not at that time. I was hoping it would be easier to.
Absolutely.
Yeah, to do it that way. But they didn't. So I never got certified to become a Tuskegee Airman. Wish I had. I've been there, but I didn't get certified. So here I am in between that testing me to go to Tuskegee, or then they said, well, you can go go to Georgia, become a Marine. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't want to be a Marine. You know, I've read enough about that. So they literally let me walk around another 6 weeks doing nothing, so to speak. Singing the choir, Glee Club we call it, and taught myself how to type.
Okay.
I won a couple of contests after that for
wow.
typing.
Okay.
And all of that. And so here I'm in waiting. Then the day came when we were going to move my outfit, we call it, uh-huh. to go overseas. In between that time, when they discovered that I had an allergy, I had to be under the direct supervision and care of the hospital, always. Every day I had to report, or every day, other day, to report so they could examine my condition. So they put me in the hospital, maybe off and on the last 6 months before we got orders that we're going to go overseas.
And what year?
This was 1944 by that time.
Okay.
Yes, 1944. Yeah. And so then the orders came down to get ready to go. We call it embarking out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in the hospital. So they transferred me then from the hospital in Texas, in Arizona at that time, Fort Huachuca over here in Arizona, because they had shifted us there.
Mm-hmm.
They transferred me from the hospital in Fort Huachuca to Camp Kilmer in New Jersey. That was going to be
Huachuca.
Fort Huachuca. Now that's spelled the Indian way. Huachuca. It's WSE Huachuca.
I can find out. Don't worry about it.
So my outfit, we put on readiness, you know, all that stuff. So I'm in the hospital in Fort Huachuca.
Mm-hmm.
They transferred me to the hospital in Kilmer, New Jersey. That's where we were going to embark from there to go overseas.
Kilmer,
K-I-L-M-E-R.
Okay.
Fort Kilmer. That's the deporting part.
Okay.
We left from there.
All right.
So they sent me then by special transportation to Fort Kilmer, where I would join my company. So I'm in the hospital then in Fort Kilmer, New Jersey. And the orders came to move out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm in the hospital. And the sergeant told my captain all this. Well, they knew I was in the hospital, that I'd have to follow them later on after I'm released by a captain who was a doctor, of course. And this captain, who was white, says, no, the nigger got to go with us. Just like that. The nigger got to go with us. Well, again, the first sergeant,
mm-hmm.
who was black, who was, we called him an Uncle Tom and so forth, says, yeah, we'll get him out of that hospital. He was big like a football player.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my buddies came by and says, they got a conspiracy going. We told him that you can join us later. This is my friend who was a sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
We came by to see you, as far as the official visit is concerned. We came by to see you before we took off. They want to take you out of this hospital. He says, we heard the captain talking to the sergeant. I just thought you ought to know right away. If necessary, you can call your doctor in and tell him whatever.
So the black first sergeant was telling you this?
Yeah. No. Yeah, but my sergeant was telling me, not this bad guy.
Oh, okay.
This was a company sergeant.
Okay.
He was not a first sergeant. He was in between there.
Okay.
And he says, I thought you ought to know that they're planning to try to get you out of this hospital. And they're going to come on the... They're just visiting you. That's not really what it is. And I said, okay. He said, just be prepared. And he left. And two or three days, maybe a day later, I missed something. He says, we are scheduled to depart, whatever the day was, so many days from now, so they're going to pull this thing, whatever it is. We're scheduled to depart on Sunday morning, the typical kind of way. He gave me the time and all that. I don't remember all the time. And just be aware of it. And I said, okay. So that morning, when we're going to leave, the day before we're going to leave, sure enough, my captain shows up, the sergeant, first sergeant shows up, and the captain tells the first sergeant, I'll go talk to the, he's not to be released, but we'll get him out of here. It just so happened in crazy coincidences, the captain that I'm talking about, of my company, happened to have been a classmate of the doctor captain, or the classmate of the major, you know, the scheduled stuff, mm-hmm. captain, major, and all that.
Right.
Who is over the hospital? I'm going to go talk to him. Just by crazy coincidence. The captain says, I mean, the major says, no, he's not to be released. Well, then my captain drew upon all this friendship about they mm-hmm. were together and all this. And he says, well, I can't do that as a medical doctor, but talk to so-and-so who's over that little ward. All they were doing, conspiring.
Mm-hmm.
Came in, whatever the time was, this other doctor, under the major, over my Carter there.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to get you out of here. We're going to dress you, and you're going to have to leave here, just like they told me. You're going to have to leave here. And we're going to get you somebody to, you know, the duffel bags or the big stuff you wear on your back, the military, that's mm-hmm. what you carry all
right.
your stuff in.
Yes.
That's why it got the name troop. A troop means you have everything here, food, everything. It's
okay.
self-contained. We're going to get you somebody to take you with the duffel bag and the walk, the plank, we call it, walking mm-hmm. up the ship. We'll get you somebody there, and you get dressed. You'll be out of here in 3 hours or whatever it is. I said, but the doctor says I'm not to leave. Well, we're going to get you some special pajamas again and some special stuff. We know about your allergy. That's why you're here. And I said, but I shouldn't be leaving them. And I quoted all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Get out of here. We're going to get out of here. And sure enough, in 2 hours...
You left?
I had to leave. I couldn't carry my duffel bag because that would be against my skin. They gave me somebody to carry my duffel bag up to plank, and you know that's a half a block mm-hmm. to the ship. To put it in my dunk bed. We stayed there maybe another day in the ship, maybe a day and a half, I don't remember. And I was out of the hospital. Luckily for me, I was smart enough also to get all the details that I told you about
mm-hmm.
and get a paper that was signed by...
So this is the details about your illness and
about
how
my
became,
illness and all that.
Okay.
I was smart enough to get all of that, but I'd been smart enough all along to keep my records going because I knew they'd snow me up with
mm-hmm.
So I had all my papers and I told my sergeant...
So you kept a paper trail yourself?
Oh, yeah.
So everything. Okay.
As a company clerk, I knew all that stuff and everything, so I kept all my papers. And I said, would you sign this, please, sir, and so forth. Yeah, we're going to sign you out of here. And they did all that stuff. So when I got on the ship with my own sergeant, my guy, I said, run me off some copies. And I said, you keep a copy. Give me a copy. And give me my can where I keep all my stuff. He did all that. I then was on the ship, and 3 hours later, we were on our way. We landed. We went by England first. Liverpool, England first. No, it wasn't. It was Dover. It was Dover, England. We stopped there overnight or whatever it was. I don't remember. And then we went on to Reims, France.
Okay.
That's R-H-E-M-S. Reims, France, where we were. That was our destination.
Okay.
When I got into Reims, France, according to the orders from that hospital, I was to immediately be admitted to...
Hospital.
I got off the ship, had somebody to take, now this is several days later, we've been going all over, you know, we've been on the ocean for 12 days, 15 days, 19 days, I think it was, all together, from the time we left Kilmer to the time we parked in Reims, I think it was 19 days, but you know, we stopped at all kinds
mm-hmm.
of places. And my orders were, Carol is to be, this soldier is to be hospitalized immediately upon arrival, for his check and so forth. Sure enough, believe it or not, after all this crazy stuff, when I got off the ship, I stayed overnight where they parked us in a big house,
mm-hmm.
chateau they call it. 2 days later, I was in a hospital in France again.
Was it an all-black hospital?
No, this was just
a veterans hospital.
This was a military hospital. You know, they had association with France and
right.
all that stuff. And... Oh, they had changed mine. I didn't know this, though. So we went overseas as quartermaker. What is it called? The quarter. They changed the outfit. The initial outfit, I should have added it, was the tank destroyers from Texas to Fort Chuka, Arizona,
mm-hmm.
was tank destroyers. I had been trained to drive these big tanks and all this stuff.
Okay.
So when we got overseas, we were part of the quartermaster. That's what I'm trying to think of. They changed us from the tank destroyers to quartermaster. Quartermaster is the military transporting of clothes and everything else from one point to the other, driving these big trucks.
Okay. So that was your job description, basically.
Essentially, that's what it was.
Okay.
I was the clerk of the company, and my job was to see that everybody did what they were supposed to do, assignments and all this, and keep record and all this. But now I'm overseas. I'm in the hospital 2 days later. I'm in the hospital with the same classification, special conditions. The doctor there is to look at their records and do what doctors do. They're coming and examine me and all this. They did in the hospital there.
Oh.
You're going to be on special duty here. You were assigned to special duty, and you'd be in this hospital, whatever it was, a week, 2 weeks, whatever it was. Your condition has worsened because you had to wear this sort of stuff, but we work on it. Now, they know nothing about all this other crazy mess that went on in the hospital. So they asked me, well, why are you here? Why did they put you in all this stuff? I just told them straight. And I said, well, I have papers here and so forth.
So you were wearing the wool things that you were not supposed to wear, even though they knew
that's
you had
right.
a skin condition.
That's right.
So they didn't try to find anything different to work with your allergy.
No, not our military.
Right.
Now, overseas, it was different because they had to be brought up to date with all this stuff.
Okay.
That is what puzzled them, what you just said.
Right.
That is
okay.
what puzzled them. How did you get over here in the first place? So I went through my whole thing. Luckily for me, and this is out of my head in here, it's good to be naive sometimes. It's good to be young and ignorant sometimes and believe that the world is fair and all this. I just laid it out. And they said, oh, okay, we'll check that out. These papers? I said, yeah, these are the papers. He says, okay. Now, these are military doctors. You still have the military protocol and all that, but that was no big deal. So they talked to me
mm-hmm.
and says, I see you wearing special underwear, military stuff. It says here that you're allergic to the Army woolen stuff. They call it GI stuff. I said, I am. I understand that your mother had to write in. They didn't believe it. I said, yeah, the note is there. They wrote my mother while I was in Texas mm-hmm. to find out, did I have a whole history, as I told them, from the time I was born. I said, yes. Flannel clothing I couldn't wear on a special type of flannel clothing as a kid at 2 months, 3 months. As soon as my parents found out that I was different in terms of what I could wear, they found out. They found out I couldn't wear that stuff. And I had to get a letter from my mother and initially backing it up. When they found out in Texas that I was allergic to the stuff, I had to write my mother to write a letter to the military to tell them that it's true. I told them. And they said, you got a good memory. I said, I just know that I've been allergic all my life to this kind of stuff. Well, what else are they allergic to? I said, this whole list of stuff. Tomato, a certain tomato sauce.
Mm-hmm.
I was allergic to tomato sauce. Today, I'm still allergic to spices and all that. I can't eat hot peppers and all that. Allergic to that. But it was just routine for me to say that.
Okay.
Here we are in France again at the bed. And so I'm in the hospital and my outfit is being... You know, it takes a month to get adjusted and all this. But they came to see me every day. Not okay. this first sergeant. I told him not to come to see me. But he came anyway many times. You're going to get out of here. You know, you think you're going to get out of this service. You think you're so smart.
So they were thinking you were just playing with this illness to get out of the military.
My outfit did, but not the official military
okay.
physicians and so forth. This was
okay.
part of the
they
official record. They right. knew. They had no knowledge of the conspiracy going on in my outfit. They were just doing what they're supposed to do as medical doctors.
Okay.
And they were beautiful.
That was a good thing. Yeah.
Oh, good thing.
Right.
And as I said, it's good to be naive sometimes because I told the whole story to them. I just told them what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
They said, what? I said, yeah. I said, I assumed that they're going to put me in the hospital when I get over there and what we call attached to my outfit. Well, didn't happen. I sit in the hospital for any number of days, and I'd go back and forth to the hospital maybe, I don't remember, once every 2 weeks to be examined. And then a couple of times I went to the hospital where I'd stay overnight while like here, to take full examination.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And to take a piece of my skin back here and, mm-hmm. and test it out and so forth. They read mother's letter and so forth and said, yeah, he's allergic to this. The doctor's thought was no big deal. You know, treat me like this. He says, you'll be over here for a while, but it's too cold over here. You don't need to be here. And with this allergy, I said, okay, I don't know, whenever we go back. Now, the conspiracy continues. They take me out of the hospital because we're going to move. My outfit's going to move from some part to, oh, it'll come any moment, Lyon, France, to Reims. From Reims to Lyon, because that's where we were, Reims. We went to other place first. I'm going to cut out the end. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Before we settled in what I was saying a minute ago, in Reims.
Okay.
We didn't go to Reims first.
Okay, that was somewhere in between.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was in this other place, and I've been back there, incidentally, later on. It's in this other place where all this conspiracy went on.
Okay.
And then we moved into the permanent place, the Reims.
Reims.
And so here I am, we're moving to Reims, and they put me back in the hospital. Same thing again. And they gave my... a record to the sergeant, my sergeant, and to the captain, to the officers. This is this soldier has to be on special duty, da 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 da. He's got a good job as a company clerk, so he doesn't have to worry about traveling back and forth into cold, because we were moving from France to Germany carrying all these outfits. That's mm-hmm. quartermaster. That's what we do. You know, every day my trucks are leaving and going and coming back overnight or whatever. But he's going to stay here. We're good. So my job then was to follow the orders, go to the hospital, and come back. I just assumed that they were going to do what the captain and the doctor said.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have any intent to do that at all. You're that smart nigger. This is Netter calling, and so forth.
Well, Netter?
Netter, N-E-T-T-E-R, Sergeant Netter.
Okay.
That was the Uncle Tom we called him.
All
Netter.
Right.
And that's the one who, professional soldier, from about 1935, and this is only 8 years later, in 1943 or so.
Mm-hmm.
So it's these days when I think of 1935, my God. But it was not too many years, you see, in 1943, because of the military, because of the civilian army at that time, and there were many blacks who found it a better life to be in the military.
Right.
I didn't
okay.
know all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So here I am in the hospital, and my outfit has to move the clothing and whatever it is up to Germany lines and so forth, and I'm keeping all the records. So strangely enough, they would ask me sometimes while I'm in the hospital, Carol, what number is this, so forth, and I said, look up so and so and so and so, and bring me the papers, and I'll tell you. While the conspiracy was going on, the conspiracy meaning my sergeant, the Sergeant Netter, and the captains and the lieutenants are all white.
Not Sergeant all Netter was black.
Netter was the black one.
Okay.
He's the first sergeant. He's the one who runs the joint.
Okay.
It's like a CEO. He's the CEO. All outfits have a CEO in the military this way. They're okay. The first sergeant.
Okay.
And he was the first sergeant, so he ran everything. Officers simply follow what the sergeants do. They're like the... And the CEO, let's see, the CEO runs it, and the chair of the board follows what the CEO says. That's the way it runs.
Okay.
Here I am then, and I'll pick up there, let's see. Any loose threads there?
That no, it's okay. Netter, and then the conspiracy consisted of Netter and the captains. And
the captain primarily.
Captain, okay.
Yeah, and I'll bring in the others in a moment.
Okay.
So I leave then the hospital on my regular days, as far as the hospital was concerned, to go back to visit and come back. The hospital didn't know anything about all this other stuff now. They put the orders in, and he's to be back in 3 days, or 10 days, whatever, for mm-hmm. examination, just like it is here. For 10 days, we take a look at it.
And so you left the hospital and did regular duties, and then you would check back in to make
right.
sure that you were, okay,
that's right.
being treated properly. And you
by the orders of the military.
Military.
And military.
Okay.
I thought it was perfect. I thought, I thought they were honest again.
Mm-hmm.
Not these conspirators. These conspirators were conspirators. One conspirator was the Netter, and the other was the captain. So I go back.
What exactly was the conspiracy?
Conspiracy was to keep me out of the hospital, so I would not come back to this to the country here as ordered, which I did. I'll bring that in a minute, because the sergeant says that I was the sergeant. Yeah, the sergeant says I was a nigger, and I was teaching my black mates
mm-hmm.
how to read and write, and he didn't want them to learn how to read and write because they should not be taught all this stuff. The military is giving them a good life. Look, I've been in this military for all these years, giving them a good life, and here, and all of them, 90% of them were from Mississippi and Alabama and the
looking for something different, looking for a better life.
Yeah, just simple. They couldn't read or, you know, they heard about the military, and they volunteered for the military, and I come in here, and I said, they can't read or write. They couldn't even fill out, some of them couldn't even fill out papers.
Hmm.
And I said, this is crazy now. Three of us had high school or college.
Okay.
Or college. And we got together and said, you know, something wrong with all this. I'm going to teach them what their rights are. He says, do that. This is other sergeant in mine. He says, do that. Let's set it up. I set it up. That was the core of the conspiracy, that I should not be teaching them how to get around or get their rights in the military. And if they couldn't read or write, it's their business. And they should not, therefore, be taught how to read and write. I thought that was ridiculous.
Okay, it was. Okay.
Yeah. Is that enough to answer?
Yes,
you?
Yes.
So here I am teaching them to read and write. Now, the other part of it is for the military, when it's like this, we're in France and the German lines are, you know, have to go to Germany. There are many days we do nothing but just sit around all the time. Waiting for this.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, this is a good time. I'll teach them how to read and write and teach them all about the military while they got all this time. It's called downtown time. And I did that. Sergeant would come in. What are you teaching them? We told you not to teach them and so forth. And I said, okay. So we worked it out at night. So I teach them. I knew everybody knew me because they depended on me. The cooks were great. The cooks were great. Well, everybody was great.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd be sitting around playing cards, the checkers, doing nothing, waiting on the orders. In the meantime, the officers, all white, would be out chasing women. In the meantime, Sergeant Knitter would be out trying to check women, too.
Mm-hmm.
So here, the only person on the campus would be the other, I mean, on the yard would be corporals and other sergeants, but not the first sergeant, which is Netter, and me and a few others. And they play checkers and do nothing, and I said, write letters to your family and so forth. Mm-hmm. So we'd have many days of doing nothing.
Right.
And my job was to know when the captain left and he'd be back. I knew his schedule. I knew what women he was after and so forth. Mm-hmm. I knew the whole thing. And they knew I knew. So here I am and my friend's coming in. Carol so-and-so and so-and-so. I said, let me look it up, so-and-so. And I said, one of them came in one day and says, my daddy's dying. This letter's already 5 days old or whatever it was. It's special.
Mm-hmm.
Or 10 days old to get the mail over there. And I want to know.
This is one of your soldiers?
One of my colleagues. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And he says, I asked the sergeant, can I go home and come right back on special orders? And he's going to die in so many days, da-da-da-da. And my whole family's going to be there. And they said, no, I cannot go. I said, tell me exactly what's said, and let me read the letter and so forth. So I did all that. I said, they may be right unless you know so-and-so and so-and-so. It's the military, and they do whatever they want to do and so forth. He says, but I had, when we talk, all them talk, he says, so-and-so got a special leave and went, his mother was dying and so forth, and they sent the papers. I said, okay, let me check it out. So I looked it up, and I came back, and I said, yeah, you're entitled to so many days, whatever it was.
Right.
And I told him that. And I did not tell him about the conspiracy. I didn't think it was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And
so they didn't even know their rights as far as leave or when they could leave and what time and what.
They didn't even know how to sign papers again, an allotment for their parents, send money back home, even if it was $35 a month.
Right.
One or two did. Most of them had no idea. They knew they were in the military at the will and of the military, and you do what they say do or they'll shoot you or whatever. That's all they knew. I said, this is ridiculous. And so I signed all the papers for him, explained to him what he had to do, and he'd sneak in and say, so-and-so and so-and-so. And I said, yeah, put this down. Well, so-and-so, how do I do this? And I said, come back, I'll show you. I did all that for two or three. They wouldn't let them come. They wouldn't let them come back. One of them, we knew 6 months before that his father was going to die. Another one, I don't remember all the details.
Mm-hmm, right.
Another one that his mother was, what the mother was.
So they wouldn't let them take leave to go to their parents?
At all. Under the whole idea about it's wartime and we're in a war zone. I said, no, we're in a war zone, but so and so and so and so. And I said, this is ridiculous. So I taught him how to do that. When the sergeant found out that I was doing that for these particular soldiers, he even became more infuriated. Now I'll pick up the whole thing, tie this all together for you.
Mm-hmm.
One day, the sergeant decided that they were going to teach, no, it wasn't the sergeant, it was the captain here, decided they were going to teach me a lesson. Every day we had to do exercise called calisthenics. Yeah. Do exercise. It was no big deal. We did it every day. But this particular day, the sergeant and the captain conspired to find a military reason for me to be court-martialed. It didn't, that's what it amounted to force me to stop doing what I was doing. And to force me officially, as far as they were concerned, make it official like we do things now. We're going to put it on paper, and we are going to find the best reason to teach this nigger out here a lesson. Those words are Sergeant Netter's words, even in front of the white officers, going to teach this nigger. He called me an uppity nigger. Now, he had 6th grade education. Never had a 6th grade education, and had gone and got military stuff equivalent to an 8th grade education. That's close enough. On this particular
day, were a high school graduate.
Oh yeah, high school graduate, and had had my stuff to go to college, had a scholarship to go to college, and the whole bit. And on this particular day, the sun was out like this, but it was cold, very cold. This is the morning we're going to teach.
And you're still in France.
Oh, yeah, still in France, in Reims, France. And we have the chateau, the French chateau. We had a big house. It was big. And the second floor was our kitchen and the dining room where we ate. And outside we had about 3 buildings. And one of the buildings on this big lot, like this table, would be where the other is. It's this far away proportionally.
Okay.
Was a chapel. It used to be a big, big plantation. It was a big, big, was a chapel, a little chapel where they married people and all that and went to service there. But we're way over here. So this morning, this particular morning, fall out. That means the orders to get ready for the exercise calisthenics. And I did. But I had a special order. I didn't have to put all that stuff on my back to march and so forth. But this particular morning, they ordered me to put all this stuff, the whole pack, we called it the pack, on my back. And I'm wondering why they're doing this. I'm the only one, when I found out later on, that I'm supposed to march out here with this pack on my back. And I'm, what the hell is this? So I winked my eye at the other sergeant. You know, how you communicate.
Right.
And he did, not the thumb, but whatever it was at that time, and winked his eye. We knew something was up. And winking the eye was a communication to be aware with this and to take notes and whatever for me on my side.
Right.
So here we march from here down there, and then we'd fall out and take a break. Except for one man, me and my pack. Had to march. They'd be resting over here. And I'm going to march. And I said, this makes no kind of sense. So I'm still naive enough for the first part of this to say, why am I doing this? Because we say so, you got a direct order to march. So all this stuff on my back, after 10 minutes or so, would be incredible itch, to say the least, would be itching. And I'd have to get air. I'd have to open it up. So I'd march, and then it got so...
Well, what happened to the medical orders that they knew that you had?
Didn't matter.
It was, okay.
Yeah, that's a good question, because as far as they were concerned, they had all the orders. They didn't know that. I'll tell you in a minute that I had kept orders. I kept copies of everything and gave them to my friend to put in a can. I'll talk about that. Put these orders in this can. I'll get to it in a hurry here. They gave me, in quotes, you have a direct order now. Anytime you don't do what a direct order is, you're subject to be court-martialed.
Right.
That's a violation. In addition, because we're in a field of battle defined as a battle zone, it's even worse because theoretically you're fighting right now. And you cannot disobey an order, for example, if you're in the field of battle. So they've done the typical kind of thing, redefine what the battleground is. I marched and said, and I threw all this stuff off. I mean, it's itching beyond belief. I said, no, I got to get some air on my back. And I pull it off. Well, you have a direct order to put it on. I said, yes, sir. I'll put it on in a few minutes after it dies down. Mm-hmm. 3 or 4 times. That's what they wanted. But I was smart enough to say, I'm not disobeying your order. I'd read all the regulations. I just have to rest up a minute to get my condition. So I won't itch.
Mm-hmm.
3 or 4 times. Now, after the second time, it all fell in place to me. It all fell in place. They're trying to get me to disobey so they can say I disobeyed a direct order, and they know I know all the rules and laws, so they can court-martial me. But it didn't matter to them. When it occurred to me, it's not going to matter anyway.
Right. They were trying to push a button.
That's what they did, yeah. But I was cool. I would say, sir, I marched 5 blocks, 5 steps,
mm-hmm.
and I take it off again. Well, order. And now my outfit is resting over here. They're watching all this stuff. And the last time I marched 10 feet maybe. And I said, it's itching again. And I'd stop and pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're ordered to put it back on. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I put it back on and walk 20 more feet. Take it off again. I said, sir, it's itching. I can't do this. And as you know, the doctors say that I shouldn't do this. Take him in. He's disobeying a direct order. I want you to write him up. All the other guys are watching this. I said, yes, sir. At that moment, they had somebody, one of the others, to take my bag with me and take me back over there mm-hmm. to the outfit and, in quotes, lock me up. We'll be over there after a while. And by this time, my sergeant, my friend, who was also from Philadelphia at that time, so we were friends, he gave me the sign up. He knew what was going on there, telling me not to worry about it. We'll take care of it. The outfit doesn't have bags on. They don't have the satchel. They're just in their ordinary clothes. They marched.
But you had the bag?
I'm the only one that had the pack on. That's what I was saying. I'm the only one that had the pack on. I said it was a conspiracy.
Wow. Okay.
So I said, okay, sir. Yes, I go back. 3 feet, no, about 2 minutes away from them, I took it off and handed it to the guy who was with me. He says, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. They took me back, and they told him where to, in quotes, lock me up.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't mean lock up. It's simply you're restricted to a particular area.
Okay.
That's what that meant.
So not said, confinement in a building or a room, but just restricted to
that's right.
Okay.
So they, in an hour or so, they came back. Then they did the formal thing that you just asked.
Okay.
They put me in a 5x10 tent on the ground in March, freezing, in a fenced in place, where it was cold, and where they gave me blankets and a mattress to sleep in. And I was supposed to use these 5 blankets or whatever it was. But because I had friends in the outfit, they were not about to let me.
Right.
So as soon as that happened and they found out where I was, my buddies brought me 10 more blankets. 10 to sleep on and 10
to cover
up with. And it 2 or 3 times in the night, hey, Carol, you all right in there? Yeah. Everybody sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Bill will be by after a while. Don't worry about it. That went on for 10 days. 10 days I slept in a 5x10 tent, as far as the sergeant and they was
and
concerned.
And this was punishment for stopping with the backpack.
That's right.
That aggravated your skin.
That's right.
That the doctors knew about.
That's
but
right.
They were
That's
okay.
right. Until they could write up orders officially, the formality, to charge me so I could be court-martialed. Which I was. I'll tell you about it. Mm-hmm. And so, but they knew I knew all the orders. They knew I knew the sergeant and the lieutenant. They knew I knew this. So I tell my buddies, look in drawer 5, 6, whatever it was, and bring me those papers, but don't let anybody. Here's the key to so-and-so. They don't know I have an extra key. So-and-so. Okay. The next morning, they delivered the stuff. That night, they delivered. And after we had breakfast and all this, and the sergeant and the lieutenant, so not the lieutenant, I'll talk about one of those, and the captain going out to chase women, using military languages, you know. And we'd eat, they'd bring me my pencil and paper. They couldn't keep the typewriter out. Now and then they, you know, the typewriter, they had these little, they didn't have the electric stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
They had the little Corona
right.
typewriter. And what's that other famous something? Corona and famous. That was my little typewriter.
Got okay.
It'll come in a minute. Corona was one of them, though. Now, sequentially, I'm in a restricted area.
Mm-hmm.
The food is brought to me and handed to me through a little gate.
Okay.
Every day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. In between, my friend prepared food for me. I ate.
Okay.
They would take care of me completely. I'd write it up. I said, there's a can that jar, and it has a top on it. All my papers, I'm going to run off copies here, and all my papers I've signed in the day, stick them down in there. Dig a hole, such and such a place out there, where you know where that hole is. So eventually I'm going to need these papers, and they're going to search me, and I cannot have any papers. But I was smart enough at 19 to say, dig me a hole out there, and I want to know where it is, and so forth. They did that.
Hmm.
All the papers from the doctor in that hospital I told you. Every paper, every time they discharge me, they have to write papers on all this. I said, run off me a copy. Well, I'd come back and give it officially to the sergeant and all that, but I always had a copy in my jar.
Okay.
Oh my, everything. I kept copies of everything. That's why I'm a historian today when I think about it. I keep everything. So, the drive through then, this is the whole thing, I'll make it short. I sent a letter to the headquarters to Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Paris was the headquarters for military command and all that. And every day they're sending, you know, communication goes to the headquarters in Paris and all this military stuff. And I said, take this out and give it directly to the man who's going to deliver it so that they know it's not from me. So I'd bring it from the office and put the official stuff in it. Mm-hmm. It'd get to Paris. Eventually, Paris got it. And they sent it back. I said, get the mail first. Get that mail. Sergeant never knew this. Get the mail first before it went to the captain.
Right.
Because I'm the Turk and I'm the one that we ordinarily receive it.
Mm-hmm.
In Paris, they don't know this. So we get it. Sure enough, they answered that they could not intervene and so forth because of military technical, if I don't have to tell you mm-hmm. that. They filed in suit to court-martial me. Now, here's the drama of this, all this. I'm in the tent out there every night. I'm eating well. I'm taking all my notes
mm-hmm.
and put them in my jar. All the notes. The day came. Sergeant, this is the way he walked all around. You are going to be court-martialed. You up a nigger tonight. I said, okay. At midnight, this is midnight or 10? No, I think. We'll say 10 o'clock. That chapel I told you about.
Mm-hmm.
They blindfolded me. A gun in my back. and walked me over to that little chapel where I was going to be court-martialed. The officer had now come down from Paris, where they knew about it. Mm-hmm. Warrant officers are the ones who are hearing officers, like judges here.
Right.
The little chapel was made like this, like you walk in, like some chapels today, you walk in, the vestibule, mm-hmm. like a church.
Right.
And the big thing starts here. So here I'm out in the office.
Okay.
I'm blindfolded, now I said, take the blindfold off that soldier. And the handcuffs, I was handcuffed. I sat out in here. The hearing, like a church, just like this is, and the officers up there. It had a choir, you walk up a stair or two, mm-hmm. and the chair up there, and the hearing officer's there, and they leave me out here, and they walk in, and all the typical kind of stuff, and he's out here, is out here, and so forth, and we get started in a moment. Where is he? He's out there. So, well, let me see him. He said, take the handcuffs off that soldier. Take the handcuffs off that soldier. And I said, oh, that's pretty good. He's not in that corner necessarily.
Okay.
They come back out, and they go through the preliminary stuff, and they walk me in. Now to the other side of it. One of the officers, call him a 90-day wonder, that is, a 90-day wonder to the military men. You bring in guys from college and so forth, and in 90 days they become a lieutenant.
Okay.
90-day wonders, we call them. We had a 90-day wonder from Florida, and I can't think of his name. I don't know why that one escapes my memory for all these years. It's somewhere in my files. A lieutenant, first lieutenant. He was second lieutenant. White, young, college, 90-day wonder. Mm-hmm. Who watched all this stuff. And he says, Carol, I'll be your witness, but you can't say that. If you need to call on me, this is the way you do it.
So he didn't want the others to know he was working with
him. He couldn't let them know. You know all the rules and so forth, so just make it short. I'll just say it short. This is where you bring me in if you need some verification. It's not right, but I can't say that. After all, I'm another captain and so forth. You know the military rules enough. So just think about at the right time, if you need some help, do that. I said, fine. Here I am, and the players on this court-martial, this trial, me, of course, Sergeant Netter, mm-hmm. one other sergeant in there, Walker was his name, friend of mine, not first sergeant, from Philadelphia, Lieutenant.
Sergeant Black, Lieutenant White.
Right. And the captain's white.
Okay.
The officer's, of course, is white. I'm the only black, aside from Sergeant Netter, in the room. That's enough. That's a setup. Just like a court here. And he says, bring him in. He said, bring me in. That's when he said,
court-martial trial.
That's right, court-martial trial. That's when he said, take the handcuffs off this soldier. And I said, oh, that sounds pretty good to me. And, take the handcuffs. What is that? Handcuffs off. Then it starts the formality. Do you know what you're here for? And I say, yes, sir. So forth. Give him a copy of the orders. Da-da-da. You'll be in charge with so-and-so, so-and-so. And it went through the tip. You have to, all the formality stuff, black mm-hmm. court here, only it's worse, military, so forth, so forth. And now the captain's understanding. He's going to give the case. And his witnesses, of course, Sergeant Netter mm-hmm. and Lieutenant, which was great for me. I wanted the Lieutenant to be one of his witnesses, and he was. And they go through all of this thing, and I'm listening. And I said, wow, they had to lie so much, all that stuff. Would you bring the soldiers on? So I'm sitting, typically, whatever the special mm-hmm. chair, whether I'm sitting there. He said, do you understand the charges? I said, yes, sir. Oh, I see that you were the clerk of the area, yes, sir. Okay, you've heard what the captain said and the sergeant. What do you have to say about that now? He says, this is military, as you know, and it's not civilian. So I'll ask you some questions, and you can elaborate on them or whatever, in your own words. So he says, name, or all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. He says, what do you say what they said? I said, sir, none of that's true. He says, what? I said, none of that's true. He says, why isn't it true? Tell me your story. Just like we're doing. Tell me your story. I read the whole thing. He says, you sure you're telling me the truth? I said, yes, sir. Now, the captain began to say, and interrupt. He says, no, no. But after the third time the captain interrupted me, the hearing officer says, I told you, Captain, I run this. Mm-hmm. I've asked you to be at ease, meaning shut up. I want to hear what the soldier has to say. So and so and so and so. He did it a couple more times. He says, one more time, and I'm going to charge you, talking to the captain. I want to hear what this soldier has to say. By this time, the hearing officer is beginning to suspect something, which was in my favor.
Right.
I went through the whole thing. He says, what? Yeah. Well, the sergeant says that the orders were so-and-so, and he gave me the order from the hospital and so forth. I said, sir, those are not real orders. Well, how do you know? I said, because I have the original orders. Captain looked. He says, you have some orders? I said, I have the original orders, sir. Captain, what are these orders that you have? Those are the original orders. He says, but you say you have the original orders. I say, I do, sir. Let me see those orders. He read them. He says, what? This whole story I just gave you.
Right.
I'd written it all up from the time in Texas when I was playing basketball and I couldn't play anymore. I read them. He said, let me take a minute or two. And when you know when he sat back.
Right.
And he didn't lean up.
Taking notes all the time he was reading.
Yeah. He says, you sure you are? I said, yes, sir. He says, Captain, these appear to be the original orders. Would you take a look at them? Those are not the original orders, sir. Here are the original orders. Hearing officer says, all right, we're going to assume that those are your original orders and these are the original orders. And he read them. He took time, read everything. And he says, Sergeant, this soldier says this happened, that happened. Did it happen? I don't want to know an explanation. Did it happen? Yes or no? No, it didn't happen. Captain, his paper says so-and-so, that he went into the hospital, the whole thing I told you.
Right.
Did that happen? Well, he was in the hospital, but they... Soldier, you said that they came to the hospital before you came here and got you out of the hospital bed on that Sunday morning. Is that what you said? Yes, sir. Sergeant, is that true? I don't want an explanation. Is that true? Did he leave the hospital that morning? Yes, sir. On whose orders did he leave the hospital? On the captain, the major who was in the hospital. How did that major in the hospital, he went through the whole thing, mm-hmm. I gave you. He says, oh. So, soldier, you were saying you were in a hospital bed on the morning that you left, yes, sir. And they came and got you out of the hospital, yes, sir. And your doctor, captain, was so, yes, sir. Captain, did you know a Dr. McLean, whatever it was? Yes, sir, I did. So that was the first thing in my favor. Well, did this doctor release him? Yes, he did. Did you know him as a soldier saying before? Yes, I did. You two were classmates at... Yes, you were at West Point? Yes. He began to put the picture together.
Okay.
He says, okay, I just want to talk to the soldier. That's all. He had had many questions now. Uh-huh. He had told this captain to shut up. For the next 20 minutes, he let me talk and answer questions. He sat back. He stopped taking notes. Well, you always have a recorder, though.
Right.
He says, how old are you? And I told him. He says, that's all? Yeah. Went through where did you graduate from and all this. He says, okay,
And at the time, how old were you? 19?
19 and a half.
19 and a half, okay.
And he says, I understand. He says, I understand. He kept saying, I understand. Who were your parents like we were doing here? Mm-hmm. So forth. He says, this is interesting. What do you plan to do in life? And I said, I don't know. I want to be a writer or something. I don't know what I said. He branched off from the silver stuff. He says, I got enough information from you, and we'll talk in a few minutes, but you're a pretty bright young man. You're a fascinating young man. You have all your records and all the history. And how did you keep these records from... I said, sir, I have my little secrets. And he says, you have an excellent memory. I said, yes.
He says, yes, you do.
And he says, how did you have such a memory? I said, I don't know, but since I've been in the army, since I've been in the military, they call it a photographic memory. Mm-hmm. And he says, I think you do. I knew all the dates and all. He says, well, I think I got enough from you, and one day I hope to see. No, that's later on. So he says, we'll call you back in a few minutes. Took me out. Back in the vestibule. Mm-hmm. Sergeant wants you to stand here. Captain wants you to stand here. In the meantime, he had talked to the lieutenant. And he says, do you know this lieutenant? I said, yes, sir, I know. I know Lieutenant so-and-so. Now, you say that all the officers were out there that were on duty that day when you were marching and so forth. I'm backing this up there. I said, yes, all of them were there. The sergeant was there, and the lieutenant was there. I said, the lieutenant saw all of this, too. I don't know whether he can say that or not, but he saw all of this happening, and he'll tell you whatever it was. I don't have to be in here. You know. Mm-hmm. He says, okay, I'll talk to the lieutenant later on. And he did. Well, I was gone. He talked to the lieutenant.
So what happened at the end of the court-martial?
Call me back in. And he says, here's what it is. He gave me. He says, you were found not guilty. But that's not the way the military says it. As far as the record is concerned, this trial did not take place.
Oh, okay.
In civilian type, it would call NOLO. You know what? I said, I know what logo. They took the Greek and all this. Mm-hmm. NOLO. It did not take place. The records will show that we had this. And the record will show that, and you'll get a copy tomorrow morning, that if you're ever asked in Washington, you have to go to the Department of the Army, it was called then. Your orders will say when you get back to the United States, you will be sent back starting tomorrow. You'll go to the hospital, and they will process you to go back to the United States as a disabled veteran on a hospital ship. When you get to the United States, you're to go to Washington, and you go to this department.
They're telling you this.
They're telling me this, yeah. You're to go to the department in Washington. You're going to be ordered to go back. Starting tomorrow morning, you go into hospital, and they will begin to order to process your papers, not your outfit, your papers, to go back in the hospital and go back to the United States on a hospital ship as a disabled veteran. When you get to Washington, you're to go to this department in the Department of the Army, mm-hmm. and take these papers and other copies. We will have mailed them back then, and they'll be on the ship with you. And if they ever ask you where you court-martial, the Army will tell you, you can say yes or no. If you say yes, you don't have to explain anything. Read your papers. From now on, as long as you live, and they'll ask you, were you ever in trouble? So you can say no, and it's okay. They will tell you how to do that in Washington. If you say yes, you don't have to answer any of the questions or the details. There's a paragraph that will be saying, this soldier was court-martialed. It didn't happen. You're found not guilty. That means that it took place, but in legal terms, it means nothing happened. It's not on your record ever that you have to say you were court-martialed unless you voluntarily say so and give this number all the information. You'll be leaving, going to the hospital tomorrow morning, and they will process that. In the meantime, you will have your other classification detached, mm-hmm. detached from your outfit, starting in the morning. In the morning, you go on sick call again, and it will start tomorrow morning. Your order for the captain will not be over you anymore after tomorrow, after tonight, nor will the sergeant, Sergeant Netter. You have to be there, of course, tonight, mm-hmm. and tomorrow morning until he orders a jeep to take you to that special hospital. I said, oh my God, look at here. Now, picking up there. He says, I hope to see you one day, soldier. Read about you. I know you're going to be writing and you don't know about college and all that, but I have a hunch that we're going to read about you one day. And I want to say, your people, you know, that was all right there. Uh-huh. Your people are going to be proud of you. I've heard of so-and-so, you know, so-and-so. This is not 1943. Thurgood Marshall, nobody was on the scene.
Right.
He would say, I've heard of Booker T. Washington or whatever it was, and all the colored people who made it. I think you're very bright. I want to congratulate you for two things, for being articulate and able to say this and being honest about it. Now, at 19, you probably don't know all this crazy. You went through all of that.
Uh-huh.
And so that's when he called me back in. He shook my hand and says, good luck. I hope to hear about you someday. In the meantime, you do not have to, after tomorrow, worry about this outfit or the captain. We're going to send him away to another outfit, the captain. We're going to detach him from that outfit. You don't need to know all the details. And the sergeant will remain with the outfit until we get another replacement for that officer. But we don't think that he did the right thing. Just like that. Good luck. I came out of there and I said, I didn't expect all that. Military? He was a great guy. He talked to me a time after that. After he left and went back to Paris, he wanted to know what happened to that. He didn't remember my name at first.
Uh-huh.
What happened to that young black Negro boy that we had to court-martial? So-and-so and so-and-so. From the hospital, they talked to him in Paris. He says, okay. Did they carry out the orders as ordered? Yes. In the meantime, the lieutenant's going to stay, and the captain, the sergeant's going to stay. But the orders is for that captain, as punishment, really, but captain, to be detached from that outfit. We do not think he ought to be there.
So where did you go after that? Were you discharged, honorably discharged?
Yep, came back to the hospital, just like they said, on a hospital ship. Went to the Washington, D.C. office of the Army.
So you went back to France.
I was in France.
You were in France. You
went to the
hospital. To the hospital.
In France.
And then
the next day.
Okay. And then from there you went to...
I was on the hospital ship until whatever length of time, 10 days or whatever it is. Then you got to get filled. You
exactly.
Know, filled. Whatever it was.
By port.
Yeah, 4 weeks or whatever it was. On a hospital ship. I went to the bed. They took all the medical records.
Mm-hmm.
Re-examined me and all this. And said, you have a serious da-da-da-da-da. We're going to take an autopsy of the body again and so forth. Your case has worsened as far as that, but you'll be all right. We're going to send you back now with special medication. I came back and went to the hospital.
In D.C., Washington, D.C.?
No, yeah. Well, I had to sign in Washington. But I went to the hospital in Virginia. What is it?
Norfolk?
Not Norfolk, but it's...
Newport News?
Keep talking.
Hampton, Virginia Beach.
You know those places. You from Virginia? Yeah, yeah. No, it's a nice little name, a hospital, military hospital.
Oh, Bethesda Naval Hospital. No.
Military hospital in Virginia.
Right. Okay. It's going to come to me.
It'll come to me in the 2 years. That's where they sent me.
Okay.
Well, you have to be discharged first, as you know.
Right.
So discharge.
So you got an honorable
discharge. Oh, yeah,
discharge.
Honorable discharge and got a whole lot of medals and everything else for it.
Very good.
Yeah, medal discharge and got 2 or 3 medals for it. Because I skipped that part, didn't I? I didn't take you need to know all that.
And then from the discharge, you went to the hospital in Virginia, hospital.
Before I was discharged. Yeah, the best part about all this is I went to the hospital while still military.
Okay.
All of what I'm going to tell you about happened in the military, which was great. I didn't know it was great.
Okay.
I had a 30-day furlough, went back to my little town in Tryon, Philadelphia first.
Mm-hmm.
At any time I wanted to, I had to report in every other day on the phone to let them know where I was.
This was a 30-day furlough.
That's right. 30-day furlough from the hospital.
From the hospital.
Yeah.
And you were in where?
In this little town of...
In Tryon?
Stanton, Virginia. Is that Stanton?
Stanton,
Virginia?
Yes.
Is that where it is?
Yes, sir.
That's where I was in the hospital. That's where I was. I got a 30-day furlough from Stanton Hospital while they looked over my records, as long as I reported in every other day.
Okay.
It was extended 60 more days.
Oh man, that's good.
I came and landed in Philadelphia on J night, what is it, DJ, D night, when we signed with Japan.
Right.
I landed in Philadelphia on that night in the middle of all those celebrations.
Wow. Okay.
And then I went to the hospital. I was to call the hospital within 5 days, whatever it is. So I landed in Philadelphia and then called the hospital as I did. Military hospital in Philadelphia. Went to the military hospital in Philadelphia to start with, and then they sent me to this Staunton, what is Staunton? Mm-hmm. Staunton, Virginia.
Okay. And from, and then you stayed at the hospital how long?
Well,
still under military care.
Yeah, under military care for, let's see, go back to September the 7th, the DJ, till February 1, till January 31, when I got discharged. I was under the hospital.
January 31, 1946.
Okay. So I went from Staunton Hospital over to, what is it? I could never, this one skips me. They sent me to another hospital in Tennessee, just over the hospital, over the North Carolina border in Tennessee.
Asheville?
It's near Knoxville, but it's not in Knoxville. It went from, I went across, they sent me, they flew me from Staunton to this other hospital somewhere in Tennessee, and then back from Tennessee to Jersey. I was discharged in New Jersey again. Not Kilmer where I went in, but I have to think about it. Come to think about it, I haven't thought about that lately.
So you were discharged in New Jersey.
That's right, in New Jersey.
So what did you do after your discharge from the Army?
Went back, well, typical stuff. I had to sign up for all the GI bills and all that.
Right.
And this is in Philadelphia now. I'm home in Philadelphia. I went through all my, talk about red tape. Gosh, talk about red tape these days. Went through all the red tape stuff. Examination at the hospital, military hospital. Certified this and certification this. I had to sign up for the GI Bill. I signed up to go to Temple University, which I did right away that year.
So you were at Temple
University
in 1946?
Yeah, let's see. Temple in, yeah, 46. I went, I signed up first for Temple in 46. No, yeah, wait a minute. I had to finish. In my little town in Tryon, North Carolina, they only had the 11th grade.
Oh, okay. Right, they had that back then.
Yeah.
Right.
So I came out with good recommendations and all of this, and I went then to one of the famous high schools in Philadelphia.
Okay.
And finished there with the recommendation that immediately I go to college and so forth, and that I didn't need to go through all a whole lot of red tape, and I did that. I went to Temple University. I finished that high school in Philadelphia.
Okay.
I went to Temple University and got in there, and that started my whole education thing.
How long were you at Temple?
I was at Temple for one full year at Temple before I went to Howard University and left and went to Howard University in 1947 and graduated in 1950 from Howard University and then came back.
I didn't
back.
Know you were a Howard graduate.
Yeah. I'm the president of the Howard alumni here.
Okay.
Did you go to Howard?
No, sir. I went to Elizabeth City and North Carolina Central.
Oh, I know where that is. I did a seminar at Central.
Really?
Where is it? What city is that in?
Durham. Durham, North Carolina.
Durham, I sure did. I love Durham. And
I do too. I love it. I love
Durham.
The area.
What's the other two?
Raleigh, Chapel Hill.
Chapel Hill.
Yep.
Chapel
That's
Hill.
Your research
I
triangles.
Love Chapel Hill.
Yes.
In the wintertime, I can't stand it. But in the fall, oh my God. I did a seminar. There are two seminars at Chapel
what
Hill.
What were your seminars on?
Let's see. At that time, I must have done them on. I do seminars
work,
on
the civil rights work.
No, I do seminars on seven different areas.
Oh, okay.
See, a seminar on that. So I went back on cultural diversity and awareness. Yeah, that's what it was.
Now, let's go back to you graduated from Howard in 1950, and after you graduated from Howard, what did you do? What was your major?
psychology, sociology, and one other. My minor was French.
Anthropology?
My minor was French.
Okay.
No, that's a crazy one I did. I mixed it in there. Psychology was a major, sociology. And what is it? I'll think of it in a moment.
Okay. And then after you finished, after you graduated from Howard?
I went back to Philadelphia and worked for the Signal Corps, U.S. Signal Corps.
S-I-N?
Signal Corps. S-I-G-N-A-L, Signal. And then C-O-R-P-S, military.
Okay.
Signal Corps. And stayed there. That was in 50, let's say, graduated, the 50. 50, yeah. I graduated. I worked at Signal Corps for 2 years. I worked some other place. I went back to Temple and got the first of master's degree.
Okay. After 2 years at Signal Corps, then you went back to Temple?
Yeah, while I was at Signal Corps in row one, went back to Temple in 1950. And got a master's degree in psychology, and then went back, and I'll talk about that, and then got another master's degree from Temple University in 1957.
And what was the second master's in?
Counseling.
Okay.
In the meantime, I'd done an internship in clinical psychology.
And where was your internship?
At on Noga Street, it was. I'll think of it in a moment. Under a psychologist.
Okay.
That's how I qualified.
Counseling your third major? You couldn't think of the other. Was it psychology, sociology, and counseling?
Psychology and counseling was part of the psychology major.
Okay.
But I had another major.
Okay.
Biological science. That's what I'm. Biology. Yes.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to think of.
So after your internship, you did your internship while you were doing your master's.
Right.
And then after your master's, the second master's in
1957. Right.
Where did that lead you?
Back it up to 1956 first.
Okay, 1956 was a good year.
1956, the summers of 55 and 56, I was a camp director in New York. Of youth, a juvenile camp director under the court system in New York called Clearpool, C-L-E-A-R, Clearpool, during the 2 summers. So it was the 2 summers of
55 and 56?
Yeah, it's going to be 55 and 56, 56 and 57. Something can get my date straight. It was 50... That's right, in the summer of 50, let's see, I started teaching in 55, so that can't be right, 54 and 55, then I guess it was the summers. It's not going to come out right because I started teaching in 55.
You started teaching in 55?
Yeah, I started teaching in 1955. I'm trying to get my date straight now. It's mixing up. Yeah. So, anyway, I became a camp director in New York under the court system for 2 summers, and I'm trying to... They're falling in place
okay.
at the moment.
Okay, we'll get back with that.
In the meantime, that's it. I got it. In the meantime, in 1954... Yeah, I got it now. It's coming in place. Yeah, that's right. In the summers of 56 and 57, I was a camp director in the summer.
Okay.
It's going to come clean now.
You were teaching in 55.
Yeah. But okay. It was 1954, I looked on the bulletin board at Temple University when I was getting a master's degree, and I was doing my counseling intern, and my doctor, Hackman, said, look, I want you to direct this department while I'm gone. I said, I can't do that. He says, you're a graduate student. You've taken it all. You know a hell of a lot more than many of the professors. I want you to run this, be the director of the counseling department at Temple University while I go to Minnesota And when I come back from Minnesota, I'm going to have a PhD scholarship for you. If you want to go to Minnesota to get your PhD and you don't have to take an exam, I'll write you in and you go, because I go out there every summer and teach. I said, oh, wow. I saw on a bulletin board, interested in teaching, no experience, sign up. I said, Dr. Hatman, I can become a teacher. He says, don't worry about it. If you want to be a teacher, put my name down. I went into the teaching program in the summer then of 55.
You went into the teaching program?
No, wait a minute. In the summer of 55 there. Oh, did I touch the wrong thing here? I went in the summer of 55. I went into the special program every day, 8 hours a day, and in the evening at Temple University under a Ford Fellowship program to teach people who never thought about teaching, for special training to work what they call the inner city schools.
Mm-hmm.
That was in the summer of 1955.
Okay.
I passed, got a teaching job in an all Italian neighborhood for 1 year. I found out that the black schools, junior high schools, were close by where I lived.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed somebody there. So they were looking around for a black person to teach in this black school, primarily black.
What year did you teach in the Italian neighborhood? This is the same
school? I taught there the first year from, so 1955 to the beginning of 56, through that semester.
Okay.
So now we're back to the summer of 1956. For the first summer, That's right. 1956, oh, I missed one step in there. Before I did, you know, the fellowship, I told you, fellow mm-hmm. fellowship, that was the summer of, what did I say, 55?
55.
That's right. 8 hours a day. 8 hours during the, full time, under the Ford thing, at Temple University.
Okay.
Morning till night, and two nights a week.
Okay.
Because I had not taken any teaching and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I recruited five other people to go with me, and we went to Temple University. At the end of that, they wanted me to be the director of the program, and I said, no, I want to get off of this during the summer of 55. That was the summer of 54 then, because mm-hmm. I started teaching 55. And during the summer of 55, they called me up and says, we understand that you might want a job in New York, because of your credentials, and you have an intern program under your belt already, psychology, to be the director of voice camp.
Okay.
So I said yes. So I went to Clearpool Boys Camp in the two summers, so we can skip one.
What is that, clear?
Clearpool, C-L-E-A-R, then two words, Clearpool.
P-O-O-L?
Right. That was a camp for juvenile boys. We had midget and then middle and senior. Under the system of the court, under the control of the court, rather than to send them to that the equivalent of juvenile hall and like our camp here, like the juvenile hall here, mm-hmm. and what do you call it, in San Diego, in California, they chose some boys who had promise, they said. And we want somebody who can understand that. And then you have to recruit college counselors and mm-hmm. train them so that the behavior is not always too cool. But under your leadership, you will train them how to handle these, because they're under our care. And it's 31 miles out of New York City in the forest, and so they're not going to run away. If they run away and get out there at night and find out the people that drive that, they'll know they're from this pool, and they will turn them in, so you don't have to worry about it. And it's not fenced in because it's way out in the boondocks.
Okay.
I said, fine. So in the summer of 55, and then you can add to, I mean, the summer of 56 and 57, I directed the camp in New York, so that you'll know.
Summer of 56 and 57, you directed.
Right, the summers, yeah.
Okay.
A little part of my history, then the rest of it should be. My job was to approve every single little boy, big boy, whatever, that came to the camp. Allegedly, these are the rehabilitative boys,
okay.
rehabilitatable boys.
So it was what age group?
Theoretically, it was from 7, but really I had 5 years old in my midget group.
Okay.
Up to 17. But we broke that too, that I'll tell you about, my famous one. Jerome, 19, he was there for murder.
So five years to 17
was the, well, really to eight, through 17, to the beginning of 18 years, really.
Okay.
So that was the age official. Mm-hmm. Now then they would get some boy who had promise that was outside of the regular, and they would say, what's he promising him? He's different. He's unusual. Jerome was my favorite one. He was in for murder.
Mm.
He killed his mother's boyfriend. At 17, he says, I don't like the way that man's treating my mother. He was, you know, the mother mm-hmm. was. And the boyfriend had beat up his mother once, twice. He was only 17 at that time. He says, I don't have to take this. That's my mother. And I'm not going to let somebody treat my mother that way. So he kept doing it. He fought him a couple of times. Next time he decided that was not going to work, and he didn't care about anything. He shot him, killed him.
Mm.
Went to court, of course.
Right.
But in court, as a bright 17-year-old in the, one of the high schools in New York that was bright, you just didn't get into that high school. It's like boys' high.
Mm-hmm.
Being dumb or stupid or average. He was way up there. He wouldn't say anything. So they sent him up, and they had him isolated from the old-timers. And his probation officer, a social worker, kept looking at him and said, something different about this boy. He won't talk much, but his language is different. The way he puts words together is different. His perception is different, but he won't say much. He needs to be under somebody in a special place, not a prison,
mm-hmm.
if they have to send him away, but I'm going to recommend him to a program that normally would stop after the age of 17. So they brought him in that day. I had to interview everybody. So they said, Carol, we got a young man here. We don't want to tell you too much about him. That's why we want you to interview him. But the social worker is recommending him to go to Clearpool. He's older than most of them, probably brighter than most of them, and he may be angrier than most of them. But he needs to be under somebody's special care who will not abuse him and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay. So we set the room up this way, and it's typical. Nothing, no security, because we couldn't build trust that way. So I went down to the court in New York City, where I did. And he's sitting over in a chair like this. And then he says, we got one more young man here, Carol, that we told him about the place. And he said he wanted to come in and talk to you. He doesn't know anything about this place. And he wants to know, what is this place they're going to send me to now? And I told him, well, he might like it out there. It's, we're out in the boondocks and wave 31 miles out of New York City. We want you to talk to him. And his name is Jerome. Jerome so-and-so. All right. I said, what's your name? He said, Jerome. What is the real life's name? He told me. Why are you here? So-and-so. Did they give you? I said, I got all your record here. Now, here's the way we operate out there. We don't have any security in terms of people. We secure ourselves. We do this. My office is an open office. My back is turned to you many times. We take all knives and so forth. We put them in the drawer. We put your name on them. If you take a gun out there, can't bring that on there. And you'll be interviewed by the counsel. I went through the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, while I'm interviewing the others, you want to sit in the office, that's fine. But you can't have a knife or anything. If you don't like what I'm saying, that's okay. That's... went through all that. He came out there. He sat in my office while I ran the other thing for 3 days and didn't say a word except, what time is it? Watched me. 3 days. He watched how I handled it. And I said, well, you know, your cabin is Bluebird, whatever it was. You got to go there at night. He says, I know that. The sergeant, the counselor would come in and get him from my office
mm-hmm.
and take him over there. He eat with the boys
right.
in his cabin. You go swimming with the boys. You come back and sit in my office. 3 days.
He wasn't in school? It wasn't a, it was...
He would not... He didn't have to go to school.
It wasn't... Okay.
Yeah. I mean, he would be in school.
It was more extracurricular activity sort of thing?
Right. But he... this was an atmosphere I created. He wanted to see who I was.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't believe me. I said, the drawer got knives in it over there. If you cannot trust it, then you can't be here. We call our counselors, da-da-da. Your cabin is so-and-so, but you got two more days. You don't have to go there. This is going to be your counselor. You got to meet him, so-and-so. For 3 days, he sat there, didn't say a word. And then the next 2 days, he only would talk to me, not a counselor. I don't believe you. I said, what? You trust everybody. I said, yeah. I could kill you. I said, we told you that down in the office. They'd probably kill you in the chair, but he says, but you'd be dead. I said, that's right. Why do you trust everybody this way? I told him. He says, while you were making your inspections this morning, I had inspected. Mm-hmm. I walked out and I looked around. I saw the swimming pool and all of this, and I looked at our schedule when we eat and all this. You trust people like this? I said, yeah. That's why you're here. You met Mrs. So-and-so. He said, yeah. I like her, but I didn't talk to her much. I said, well, why didn't you talk to her? I don't trust her. I don't trust anybody, but I like her. I trust her. That's all he would say, 3 days. One day I said, you've been here now 3 days. You need to decide. I've decided, he says. I like that cabin over there, so-and-so. Can you handle it? I can handle it. I said, no. I take your word like you see me. If you can handle it, you can handle it. But if you can't handle it, you got to go back. I know. I watched it. I read all the rules. He was a ferocious reader. He says, I know all the rules. I can handle it. I said, you can handle it? Handle it. Go. You know where the cabin is? Yeah, go. Tell him I sent you over there. All right. And that was how he got introduced there. When we got ready to leave, now, I'm the only one that knows he's there for murder.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else knows. That's the way I know. When we got ready to leave, the buses would come up and take him back to town. Well, several times during the summer. They were there for, say, 90 days. But when they got ready to go, they'd have to get discharge papers from me. The bus came, and I said, Jerome, your time is up, you know, this week or whatever it is. And I said, you ready to go? No. I said, well, what? He says, okay. The bus came. He didn't want to get on. And he says, I don't want to go back. I said, okay. I want to talk to your social worker? I guess so. He says, I don't want to go back there. I like it here. I've never been in a place like this before. In the meantime, he had given me the whole history. I was the only one that knew his whole. I still had it written down, his whole history.
Mm.
He said, well, they locked me back up. I said, not on my recommendation. If I recommend that they don't lock you back up. He says, I had time to think here. That's what I did many times in the cabin when they were gone. He said, mm-hmm. I was thinking I could kill you, I could kill my mother, I could kill everybody, but that's not what I want to do. I want to be like you. I said, yeah. He says, okay. When the bus came, I said, Jerome. He says, I can't get on that bus. I'm not going back yet. Is there another bus coming later? I said, yeah. I said, mark off, cross his name out. I'll talk by phone. Mm-hmm. To the man down there, the director, and we'll make some other provision to get Jerome back down there. He sat and watched him get on the bus. He walked around for several hours while I was still there, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, you know, the camp got to close down in a few days because the man will be here to close the pool and all. He says, I know. I'll be all right. He laid out his whole history again to me. And he says, one day I'll look you up. I'm ready to go now. This 3 days. I'm ready to go now.
This was after 90 days?
Mm-hmm. He says, I can handle it now. I said, okay. He says, yeah, I can handle it now. I'm glad they didn't send me to prison like with someone because I'd be an ex-con and I'd be killing people. He says, See you later. I said, I'll call the bus now. He says, I don't want to get on the bus, really. Is there another way to get back to town? I said, yeah, you get it. When the bus came, I said, I'm ordering you a car now to go back. He says, no, I decided I'd go on the bus. I said, okay, good. You going on the bus with the others? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You got any weapons, anything? And you know. He says, whatever was in the drawer in my name, I got it. I'm ready to go back now. Lady came, so special cases like this, they'd have to meet me and the special social worker downtown in the judge's office. And I said, Jerome, I have all your history down. You have to meet your probation officer and so forth. He said, I know, I can handle it. I said, okay, I have to write a report, as you know. I've written all my personal stuff up, the stuff you don't want anybody to know, I have it. And he says, I know you won't let anybody know it. I can talk to her now. I can handle it. And he says, I can handle the court now. In 90 days, he'd grown up.
Hmm.
He says, how can I reach you? I told him. He says, I'll talk to you. So, and I get kind of crying when I talk about Jerome. He was one of the few that really touched me. So he says, I'll handle it. He did. Took him back downtown. I made arrangements for the judge. I said, Judge, I'd like to talk to you in your quarters first. But I want Jerome to be in there when I talk to you. He says, good enough. And I gave him the special. He says, he's a great guy. He told him, this is a different judge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this judge is the same one like when I had my court martial. I expect to see you someday, Jerome. What do you plan to do? He laid it out to him. And I was in contact with Jerome for the next summer, and I lost contact with him. That was my best special case, Jerome. Mm. He was a great guy.
Always will remember.
Oh, yeah.
So once you left the camp that summer,
I went back. Then the next summer, I taught school.
Okay.
Yeah. The first two summers,
school?
I decided I didn't want to. I was in school night and day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All of us were night and day under the fellowship. During the first year, we had to go to school three nights a week while I was teaching.
Mm-hmm.
That was part of the deal. And the next summer, by the summertime, I said, I don't want to be in school. I want to be out. So I went back that next summer. And then after that, I didn't go back anymore.
Okay. So when did you teach school? You taught?
1955 through 1960.
Fall.
In the fall, yeah.
1960?
Yeah, through
1960. Elementary school?
Yeah, no. Junior high and high school.
Junior high.
One of the famous high schools that Will Chamberlain went to.
Okay.
Overbrook.
Overbrook?
High, yeah.
Overbrook in high. New York?
In Philadelphia.
Philadelphia.
Yeah, everything was in Philadelphia. One other thing that you mentioned, I missed. Oh, yeah, talk. In the summers, that's those two summers. So now we're to the summer of what, 57?
Now we're at the fall of 19. You're teaching from in junior high and high school, 1955 to 1960.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So then after that, what did you do?
Okay. There's another chapter in my life that I have to spend a little time also. I taught at two junior high schools.
Okay.
I'll think the my favorite that in a moment. But when I went into teaching, the typical thing is they wanted to give us, like they do now, all the bad kids.
Mm-hmm.
I said, good. So I had, the first year, I had two regular classes. Let's see. No, I had one regular class, two bright classes, and two, in quotes, dumb classes. Now, that's what they call the kids. One regular class. It's two bright on the bright end and two on the low end. Now, being naive, which helped me again.
Mm-hmm.
I said, so they sent me the bright kids. That was okay. And then the, in quotes, as they call them, the dumb kids. Well, I didn't know that they were supposed to be dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Unteachable, couldn't learn. And so I had these classes. They, like kids today, dropped out of school. They'd come now and then, just the same thing today.
Mm-hmm.
And half of them didn't have, they were poor. Some, you know, the pants would be up, they didn't have good pants or anything. And the girls were the same way.
Mm-hmm.
No decent clothing except their mothers was on welfare and all this. So they dropped out of school. They're not going up there. Nobody would listen to them. And we call them all kinds of names, just like we do today. Mm-hmm. Dummies and all this, the yellows and the blues and all this. So they heard that there was a teacher up there at Shoemaker High School. Shoemaker Junior High at this time. Yeah, Shoemaker. A new teacher up there. We're going to check him out. So they'd come in, just like now. They come to school one day a week and so forth, and the word got out. There's a teacher up there. He's cool. You need to meet him. And so they come up. Hey, teach. I said, hey, you new teacher, yeah. How did you get here and so forth?
Mm-hmm.
I said, well.
Kind of sizing you up.
Oh, they sized me up. Taller than I am. That Spartan age, you know,
right.
6 feet and so forth.
That's right.
I said, what brings you back here? I just heard you were here. "You're supposed to be so cool." I said, "Yeah." "Come in and have a seat." This slow class, slow learners, we call them. You got to read my paper about slow learners. Slow learners on that end, bright on this end. I could handle the bright, that was no deal. But the slow learners were supposed to be taking the same classes. Math and science, that's what I taught, math and science. I did not know they were not supposed to learn, so I proceeded to teach them because they were supposed to learn.
That's right.
These other teachers, except for Miss One, she was beautiful, the two teachers, Miss Parker. She was in their corner too. She treated them like they were decent people. Mm-hmm. They only liked me and Miss Parker. So I would expect them to sit down and so forth. When they get out of order, I'd say, "Hey, sit down." Well, they wanted to give me then the next year, take my two slow classes away. And I said, "No, I want them." We had ourselves a ball. I had an aquarium in the back because I talk science. Mm-hmm. And put water and snakes and everything else back there. "Oh, you can't do that." Second year. "You can't do that. Summer's going to come next week. You can't have the aquarium in the back with snakes and stuff. No, you can't have that." I said, "What do you mean I can't have it?" "Well, you know, the school closes during the summer." I said, "Except that the doors are open and I'll get my class organized." No, black vice principal. It said, before this, it said, "Well, you know, we want you to be vice principal. We thank you." I said, "I don't want to be vice principal. I love teaching. I taught those kids science, snakes, animals. Taught them how to take care of the animals in the back. And then one little guy could hardly see." Mm-hmm. "Big glasses, this thick. Jewish kid. Stunted. Says, I'm a rock hound." I said, "You're a rock hound?" "Yeah. When we get to the unit on rocks, I can help teach you." I said, "You can?" He says, "Yeah. I'm a rock hound. I know all that stuff." I said, "How do you know all this stuff?" He says, "Well, ever since I was 4 years old, we've been going to Hawaii." Mm-hmm. "On the beach. And in my basement, I have all the rocks from the beach. And I have a big, big microscope. I can't use it right now because I'm on restriction because I almost burned down the house." I said, "Okay, but I'll help you teach this. I said, "All right." I organized my classes. All of them had presidents, vice presidents. We met every Monday morning, and we had our regular stuff. I took those slow learners, and we won several awards in the General Assembly over the next 3 or 4 years ahead of those other kids.
Mm.
And I said, "I don't want to lose those kids. We had a ball. They can't learn some things we know. They don't conceptualize like we do. Mm-hmm. But they know a lot of stuff. We had ourselves a ball." Now, I've written all this stuff about it. I'll let you read. It's called Slow Learning, Teaching the Slow Learner.
Oh, okay. I'd love to.
We won several awards. They wanted to take my slow learners away, and I wouldn't let them. It was no problem with the bright kids, obviously.
Mm-hmm, right.
So there was no problem with the bright. I taught the math and science to slow learners, and they knew it, and they learned it. And they didn't use the book always like we do. They didn't know it from the book. They knew it from their own experiences with it.
Mm.
And so I had to turn down 2 promotions. They wanted me to be a supervisor in the Temple University. We had to go back at night for the first 2 years. That's how I got my second master's degree.
Okay.
Yeah. And they had to certify that I'd come back, and then I got the second master's in education and counseling. And during the summertime, I didn't want to go back during the summer, so I didn't do that. So they came in and said, "We want you to be a supervisor of other persons under the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation." I said, "I don't want to be a supervisor." "Well, you get more money." I said, "I know that, but you come and teach." "Yeah, but I don't want to do that. I would love teaching the classroom." Principal came in, the vice principal first. "You know, we've got good evaluations on you, and you get along with kids, and everybody likes you. How would you like to be a vice principal?" I said, "I don't want to be a vice principal." "Oh, man, you can be a principal soon, as bright as you are. They know you're down at the Board of Ed." I said, "I don't want to be a vice principal." A month passed. A supervisor. Now, a supervisor is like any other. you have a whole area, mm-hmm. a district, and you have a supervisor of those who are teachers. Like I said, I don't want to be a supervisor. The third year was down at the Board of Education, they have applications for becoming a principal, and in your case, you can skip the vice principal and become a principal. You'd be in training for a whole year under somebody. But
so was this at the junior high school that they wanted you to be a principal?
Yeah.
The same school that you had where you had the one regular class, the two bright, and the two slow classes? Okay.
I turned it down. I said, I don't want to be. My wife later on says, you're a crazy man. I said, I know it, but I love what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Let's see what else. That's me. That's the story there.
Okay.
I wrote, I have names in my files right now, half of them, and I wrote up articles then.
Okay. So after your junior high school stint, how long was that? 4 years?
Five years. All together.
Yeah, 55 to 1960.
Yeah.
And then after that, what did you do?
In 1960, it snowed in 1960 in Philadelphia, and we just bought a 1957. We were one of the first five people to buy a little Volkswagen, call it the Bug, mm-hmm. in Philadelphia. And in the winter of 1959.
To buy a Volkswagen.
It snowed, yeah. Volkswagen, we bought a 1955.
So when did you get, okay, we're skipping some, we're going to the education, but you're saying your wife, when did you get married?
55.
Okay. In Philadelphia?
In Philadelphia.
Okay, now we can go to
that. We got married, we actually didn't get married till, no, that's not going to come out right, till 50. 57, I guess, we actually got married.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you and your wife were one of five people, or one of five, the first five blacks to buy a Volkswagen?
One of the first five people.
Oh, okay.
And the second black in Philadelphia to buy a Volkswagen. A 1955 Volkswagen. What was it, 1957?
Yeah, you had said 57.
It was a 57. We went to Volkswagen. Yeah, it was 57 because I started teaching a 57 Volkswagen.
Okay.
It snowed in 1960 and got over the top of my Volkswagen.
Oh.
And the schools closed for, I don't know, 2 weeks, whatever it was. And I said, sweetie, this is enough. I've had it. Oh, the lights came back on.
Yeah, they
did that. Yeah. And I said, this is enough. Call your sister up in Los Angeles and tell her we're going to come out there. She called her up right then. She says, when this school is over, this school year is over, this is 1959, then it would be.
Uh-huh.
When this season is over, we're going to move in on you in Los Angeles.
Okay.
That's what we did. We had two cars. We drove both of them across the country.
So you moved in 1960 to Los Angeles?
Los Angeles. We drove one car together, and then I went back and got the Volkswagen.
And you moved here with your wife. Did you have children?
No, we didn't have children.
Okay. To Los Angeles, and once you got in Los Angeles, what did you do?
From Temple University's bureau, they had recommended me to become a professor of psychology, teacher of psychology, at Long Beach College at that time.
Right.
They had recommended my wife to be, she taught special schools for girls in Philadelphia for many years. They had a job for her already set up.
Okay.
In Los Angeles, a teacher's special school. When I got here, I went to, after a few days, I went, as expected, to Long Beach College.
Okay.
When they saw me, I was black. No job. Again, the same thing. They wouldn't hire me because I was black.
Mm.
I called
up. That was 1960?
1960. I called up Temple and I said, you know, there's something wrong. All such bureaus, they have associations with mm-hmm. colleges and universities, and they had recommended that top students, me, to be a professor there, a teacher of psychology. And I said, they wouldn't hire me. This is why not? I said, I'm black. They said, I said, we're going to file a lawsuit. They said, okay, but let's see where we go with it first. They called up. They called me back and said, yeah, there's no need for us to fight them. We took them off of our list, and we're going to recommend against them as opposed to positively recommending. We will recommend from now on that nobody goes to Long Beach.
Okay.
In the meantime, do you want to institute a lawsuit? I said, I think so, but we're talking it over with our attorney now. We did. We talked it over. And we decided to sue them. So we filed the suit against Long Beach. The agreement was that they would tear down the bars of color and would open it up. And again, in my life, as coincidences work, the brother who got the... I left there. I didn't try anymore there. The brother who got the job as a result of my lawsuit is a good friend, and we've been friends for 40-some years.
That is wonderful.
He, psychologist, we belong to the same association.
Mm-hmm.
We talk all the time.
Is that the American Psychological Association?
Association, yeah.
Okay.
We belong to the Association of Black Psychologists called ABPSY. We'll have our conference this year. I'm the... Last night was, what, Wednesday night?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a moderator for teleconference every 2 weeks on the phone for 2 hours with the officials and so forth. And he's part of that. But he and I got to know each other. So later on, I got this call that says, my name is Joe White. I said, yeah, who the hell is Joe White? He says, I'm a teacher, a professor, well, the title is a assistant professor, whatever it was, but at Long Beach. I said, Long Beach College? Yeah. Of course, it's going to be Long Beach University soon.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I understand you've been here. And I said, I've been around there a while. Hey, brother. I said, yeah, let's meet. We met. He stayed there. He stayed there for till he retired. No, he went from there to Irvine up here. Irvine.
Mm-hmm.
And he stayed at Irvine until he retired a few years ago.
Is his daughter Lori White?
Yeah.
She used to work here? She worked here a couple of years as something that student affairs. She was the associate.
I got to call him and see if that's his daughter. I'll find out.
Because I know her father was a professor, and I know it was psychology,
right?
And I remember Joe White. I remember that name.
That's his daughter, I'm sure. Let's call Joe up. We'll find out. Find out.
Okay.
I'll go to our office.
Yeah,
because I'll be seeing him soon. So
ask him if his daughter worked at San Diego State University.
I think it was. I think that was his daughter. Well, to make that sure, I went on then and said, well, he says, I understand that you've been here, the way we put it. I said, yeah. He says, brother, I got to meet you. I said, okay.
What was the time frame between the time that you didn't even, you know, that you filed a suit and that Professor White worked there?
Must have been about 2 years.
About 2 years.
Because from there, I'll just go through it rapidly. I said, this is crazy crap.
Mm-hmm.
I went from there to the city schools in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And filed for positions in city schools. They wouldn't hire me there either. I have all the scores. I kept all the scores of the city schools. I said, looks like another lawsuit's coming up. I met with the superintendent of schools, the head of the pupil personnel is called then, and I said, no, I don't think I want to be a psychologist for the school district. I think I want to sue you. We went through the whole process. I didn't have to file it because they got the message and said, we break down these barriers. I would have been the first psychologist for the school district, though I would have been the first psychologist at Long Beach.
Right.
But the whole area was infested with racism and everywhere. So I said, this is crazy. So then, my wife is already teaching. She didn't have any problem with that. So I said, okay, where am I going to get a job? So I went then to the county and applied for the county as a librarian, library something, something, something. But my job was to...
Maybe
roll
library media spec? No, I knew it
wasn't
media.
No, it was a temporary job they had. What, you push around the things and put books? Yeah, like this.
Oh, okay. Book carts.
Yeah, that's what I did.
Okay.
That's all we
shelving.
Got.
Shelving.
Yeah.
It was shelving books.
So I said, I don't care. I don't care what it is. I need a job. I don't care. So I went there.
That was the county?
Yeah, with the county of Los Angeles. They had me. And then I began to look at the bulletin boards and see what else. Well, I'd gone through that the last years before, like probation department, probation officer. You know, I went through the whole thing. Mm-hmm. One day I saw on the bulletin board, the lady, my supervisor, Lillian, came to me and she says, no, her name was Sylvia, came to me and says, what education do you have? And I said, I went to college. She says, yeah, I asked the personnel officer, let me look at your file. Why are you doing this? I said, to make some money. She says, okay, why don't you look at the bulletin board around there and let me look around and see. So she took me off of this and says, I want you to sit over that desk over there and do this and do that till we get I want some people to come in and talk to you. I said, okay. So for about 3 weeks, I think it was, I sat. She says, come over, I want you to meet lunch and so on. An announcement came through looking for a probation officer. She says, you can do that. I said, yeah, I was officer earlier. She says, you can do that and you can get the job because they have so many openings. Here's the application. Tell them you work for me for this department and then they'll come eventually get down to me. You're going to get the job, so you don't have to worry about that. So I was hired as a probation officer for the county.
In the school? Or just for the county of Los Angeles?
Oh, okay. Los Angeles County. Then I went to juvenile hall.
And what year? Was that still 60?
That was the 19... No, that was... that was still... 61.
61.
Okay. Let me see. My goodness. I never thought about that date since then. Let's see. 60... I went... That was 61. Yeah, that was in 1961.
Okay.
I went down and they said, you don't have to have a test. You've been an officer. I skipped that, but I get that later. You've been an officer before. I said, yes. You were a junior police officer while you were at Howard University. I said, yes. He says, oh, come on in. They gave me a little test, whatever it was. I became a probation officer at Juvenile Hall. Again, I became a supervisor of midgets and a trainer of others, just like I'd been in Temple, New York. And again, they said, you know, something about you is different. I said, I don't know. What is all this different stuff? Well, we want you to be a special teacher of other, trainer of other probation officers. You've been in court a lot. I said, yeah. We see you also have had a lot of law stuff, and yes, I had all that stuff. So I became a probation officer.
Okay.
I became a...
How long were you a probation officer?
3 years.
Okay.
Remember that, 61
to 64?
64. 2.5 years. Oh, wait a minute, that's not coming out either. Let me put it through my sequence first. 2 years I went over to Senate Los Angeles Commission on Human Relations in the beginning of 63, 64, I came here. Yeah, 3 years, 2.5 years.
Okay.
Roughly 2.5 years. I get these dates straight as I go along now, put them together. And I taught probation officers themselves. I taught counselors themselves. I taught how to testify in a court of law. I taught what they should say and not say. I taught them how to keep records, how to record. And again, my training back in the military came in. Mm-hmm. You know, this is how you keep records. This is what we need to know. These are the pertinent things. I taught them how to do that. Still got all that stuff. In the fall of 61, at 62, I'd been there. At 62, I got this call that said, we understand you're so-and-so. We'd like for you to come over and look at another department of the county. We need people of your talent and so forth to help us with the human relations stuff in the county of Los Angeles.
Okay.
We understand that you have special talents with cultures and young men and women and so forth, you can teach them We don't have an opening right now, but we're going to put you on the list, and you will not have to go through all the tests. You've been you already qualified. We qualified you already. The opening should come up soon. The man you need to know is John Bugs. He's the director of the Human Relations Agency for the County of Los Angeles. He's worldwide known Human Relations Agency, and it trains with all the riots and stuff that they expect in the hot summers. They expect it to be hot in many cities and so forth, and we're gearing up so that we'll have a good staff. We think you could be help us out. 2 days later, who calls me but John Bugs?
Okay. And he was John Bugs was
an executive director, black brother.
Okay.
My mentor, my hero, black brother at the L.A. County Commission on Human Relations.
Okay.
Now, so we're around at 62 by now. Yeah, 62. So he says, bring you over pretty soon. I don't know what year, how soon. Soon as we get an opening in the staff. So 2 weeks or so later, he called me. He says, we're going to get you open anyway. We're going to make you open. We need you here from all this stuff. You don't have to go through all the training. We understand. I've looked at your stuff here. Brother, what you been doing? I said, I don't know, John. I don't know. But all of them telling me you should be on the staff here. You don't have to go through all the hoops and so forth. Come on over. Let's have lunch. John was 5'7". 5'7", short. And he saw me. He says, I guess you a giant to me. I said, yeah, John. John was a beautiful man. He just died. He died later on. Mm. So he says, I want you to come over. You can't come yet, but here's when you're going to start. I'll let you know when we start. But want to get all the processing out of the way right away. I said, okay. So we got all the processing out of the way. And I stayed at the probation department. I don't know how. I'd have to go through my memory on this. And I said, what are we up to, 63?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, up to, 62. So by the end of 62, he says, I got you, the end of 62, I got your appointment approved by the Board of Supervisors. I have to go through all that. He says, no problem, but they're having some difficulty here.
So you were still in the probation department, the juvenile probation, but you were working on the Human Relations Commission.
Yeah, as an consultant. It wasn't called a consultant, as an adjunct.
Okay.
Because the official title of all the staff persons officially at the commission was consultant.
Okay.
So you use a different word there. So he says, as you probably know, we've been in the news lately with the gang. Now, this is the time the gangs were the famous gang problem in Los Angeles. I mean, gangs everywhere. It reached its peak the next
day. Like the Bloods and the Crips in then.
Yeah, back then. Okay. And we had about five other names. He says, I want you to think about it. We know your experience and so forth. I said, okay. He says, I'll bring you on as soon as we get the budget approved. You already approved otherwise, but the budget. And so in 63, roughly in August of 63, I think I'm right there. I haven't had to think about this part lately.
Huh.
Roughly in the latter part of 63.
Okay.
Wait a minute, 62, I'm up at 62. Carol. I trained in the probation department. I trained them in the latter part of 61, 62, 63. I testified in court 50 times or so. 63. Had to be latter part of 62 then, and leading way up to 60, beginning of 63. Roughly beginning of 63. They fall in place anyway.
Okay.
One day I got
to
call.
Exact.
Yeah, we'll say 63. I got the call that says, you're on and you got an assignment already. I said, John, what do you mean I got an assignment? I'm going to tell you what it is, but you got an assignment. He says, it's about all the gang stuff here. We need somebody who's going to be the liaison from our staff, from the county, to the police department and to the sheriff's department, who do not have to go through all the ABCs. Well, you know what to do. Liaison because the Commission on Human Relations was the group in Los Angeles where all the stuff sifted through.
Okay.
That was the agency for human relations, meaning race stuff, race riots, whatever it is, and the gangs. So we had the county had a gang unit.
All right. Okay.
But they depended upon the Commission on Human Relations to be able to train some of those people to deal with the different communities, ethnic communities, mm-hmm. in the whole county. And part of the area was that you had the whole area from Watts all the way down to Watts, which was my area later on, Watts all the way up in Los Angeles County, and into the valley, because that was my area too. But I'll think about it in a moment, because I went to the prisons out there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'll think about it in a minute. He says, we need somebody. The gang thing is running wild. They have a special gang unit in the county. It was world famous. But I'm not sure they have all the ingredients for people to understand why gangs exist.
Mm-hmm.
From your experience and so forth and what you've been doing, and I had already testified in the court many, many times from juvenile hall, because I taught them how to write up and stuff. I think you can help us. I came over, and my assignment was Watts, the southeast Los Angeles. And your first job in February to be to help us write a report that goes through the Attorney General of the state of California about gang control. We're making some corrections over there. But we hear there's problems in Watts and other areas down there, and I'll think of the other areas. And there's a center down there, and we think you can go in that center and help them, because something's going to explode there. So in January, that's right, I got it now. In January, around from 63 to 64 or so, I got the copies. We wrote a special report to the Attorney General of California that we had some hot spots. Mm-hmm. And one of the hot spots was Watts and southeast Los Angeles. And if something is not done about it, it's going to explode. We're likely to have riots there. We wrote it down. And so we had a conference in the L.A. County Commission where we brought in all the big shots, all the supervisors and the chiefs and so forth, and Sheriff Pete Pitches, who was the sheriff at that time, and then Parker was a local police. Everybody hated him, hated Parker.
Bernard Parks?
But Parker was like in the military, old-timer.
Okay.
He called some of them niggers at a time, but he had the good sense to listen to the commission and some others, and he did appoint a special woman. Her name was Vivian. Vivian became his special liaison to the black community. He had one to the Hispanic community as well, okay. Though he couldn't believe in them, but he had somebody. And he says, we need somebody to work with the park and all these, and you're going to be the special liaison to the police department. Now, we know you can handle it, so you don't have to go through the ABCs. But he's everything that you hear he is, an SOB to the black community and Hispanic community. He's everything, so you need to know that. I said, I can handle it, John. He says, I know you can.
He was the Los Angeles Police Department.
Head of the police department for years. He's known the world over. Parker. And I said, okay. I came on board then running with L.A. County Commission. I helped write the initial report. I helped organize a conference that I told you with the Attorney General, through the Attorney General's office in Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
And our report, and I got a copy of all this, our report says something's going to happen, explode, if we don't do something about it. This is before the riots watch. We pinpointed the area. We told them what was needed. Oh, we're not going to have riots. Well, I was at the conference when we held in January in Los Angeles. I had not been part of the original staff, so they didn't know me, but I was part of the conference itself,
mm-hmm.
and in charge of a particular area to help put it together. I don't have to tell you, later on that year exploded. No, Watts didn't explode to 65 for another year.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I worked in Watts, Bellflower, no, let's see. Oh, my goodness. I'm forgetting these areas to Watts, and I'll think of the other areas. Well, Englewood at that time, that's what it was. The next case was a Dr. Williams that lived in Englewood, physician.
Okay.
Physician, black physician, the major physician that lived in Englewood. They were having difficulty out there because they didn't want any blacks in there. So we got the call that Dr. Williams was having difficulty with Englewood and so forth. Would I go out and handle that case too? I did. Now, let's skip 63, 64. This is beginning of 64 then. Let's
skip that
time. 64, I have begun to put this conference together in early 64. And was assigned to Watts and all those areas and wrote reports and met and did a whole thing. Like in a typical day, I went to five or six areas. I met with all kinds of people.
And this was as the...
As a member of the board, county commissioner. I loved that job because it was busy all the time and meeting with people all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the office maybe 5 hours a day, and the rest of the time, not that many days. Some days I wouldn't be in the office at all. We went down to our whatever assignment was.
So was this your major job being on this commission?
Yeah, full time.
I missed something then. So what happened with the probation and the juvenile?
Oh, that's when I said the early part of
63, right.
I just transferred over Bedford County. I went from the probation department at a lateral transfer over to the Commission on Human Relations. Now, a couple of highlights then, so we can move on. A couple of highlights. I met with Parker and Vivian.
What was that?
I met with Parker, the police.
Oh, okay.
He didn't like us. Said so. And Vivian. Then I was the sheriff department too. Law enforcement. In the year 1964 or 63, got a call from the sheriff got a call from the Muslims, black Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
Black Muslims. I don't know if I brought this in my. I think so. Black Muslims. That they had to be served papers. The famous 26th Street. Everybody knows, in Los Angeles.
Okay.
I can see the building now, the black Muslims. You know how they stand out at that time? They would stand out in front of the building, sell papers, and they'd always be like this, and mm-hmm. phone call, you know, and all this.
Were they wearing the bow tie?
Oh, the whole thing, yeah. Muslim, Malcolm X. They got a call. I might have to bring that one. They got a call that said they had to move. I don't remember what the details were, but it was a legal paper from the sheriff's department, the courts, that ordered them something. LA conviction. I don't think I brought it. I'll bring it in. I think we got to get that one. So
okay,
they had to be served papers. The sheriff's department in their uniforms had gone down there two or three times and said, "Whitey, don't come in here. Bow tie." Their guns.
Mm-hmm.
The sheriff's department told their officers, "Look, try to serve the papers, but if you can't, go push it. Call commission." And John says, "Hamlet, I met with the sheriff's department for about 4 hours and got the whole picture." No, about an hour, got the whole picture. They've got us her papers, and they don't want it to explode as a riot and so forth. And they went through the whole thing. I said, "I don't need it anymore. Where are your papers? What do you want?" "They have to sign that the paper's been served." I said, "Okay, so just give me the general stuff. I don't need details. I can fill that in." He says, "Read it there." I said, "Okay, don't talk anymore. I got it. Who's going to be my liaison director to you?" He says, "Talk to, I don't know, Beam Jones, whatever it is. He's your liaison. You're authorized to do whatever you have to do, and let us know. The commission is." I said, "Okay, ain't no problem." Get in my little Volkswagen.
Mm-hmm.
Go out. "Hey, brother. Got out. I want a piece of bean pie first. No, give me some of that bean pie first, baby." "Okay, but what about some meat?" I said, "What you got?" "Hey man, we got some fish today." I said, "Give me a piece of that fish, baby." Sit down at the table. And "Are you the one they're going to send out?" I said, "Yeah." He sent me out to just some sheriff's department. I said, "Don't worry about it. We'll handle it. Just don't worry about it. I'll handle it. You tell me what the problem is on this end." He said, "Well, we were expecting a brother. We were expecting somebody to come down, but we were not going to let anybody in here who's not a brother." I said, "I don't blame you." I said, "No, they're not supposed to come in here. This is our place, baby. This is our place." And I knew the place pretty well. So it's not too far from USC.
Oh, okay. So, okay. And it's still there?
Yeah, it's still there.
Okay.
Oh, I'll tell you what I'll have to have today. The place is still there. And last year, I met the brother of the uncle. His uncle, and his father, and the whole family who owned this building. And we put that together. I said, "Come on, baby." He says, "Yeah, man, that's me." And then we talked about, I said, "Come on." He says, "That's who I am." He says, "Wait a minute, you were the brother that did so-and-so?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Is that building there with it?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "What about upstairs?" He says, "It's still there. It's been renovated a couple of times." I said, "What about the store?" "Still there." I said, "Come on." So we're going to visit it. And he may be, 2 weeks ago we decided, before Christmas, he may be part of my family, I'm not sure. But we got all this stuff together.
That is
incredible.
Amazing. Yes.
But that's not the most incredible. I'll get back to that later on. So I have these papers in my hand. I said, "Look, we don't have to discuss this, baby. Give me my fish, my potato pie, my bean pie." And I said, "Read it over. Tell me what we have to do. You want me to bring the papers or what?" He read it over. He says, "That's where they should have done it first. Had a brother come out here. We ain't against the papers and so forth."
So the papers were papers them to leave.
No, I don't. I said I didn't remember exactly what it was.
Oh, okay.
They were.
Okay.
But I think the papers were. I'm not sure because I just don't have that in my head.
Yeah, but the papers were from the
had to be served through the court.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the sheriff's department, like the marshal's department,
uh-huh.
The sheriff's department was the one directed to serve the papers on the black Muslims.
Okay.
And they couldn't get in even to serve the papers. They're not about to let him talk to somebody who could sign for them.
Okay.
And they had their hands folded, you know, the whole bit. Since if they wanted to talk to us, the whitey, then why did they call a brother or sister to send the papers out? I said, "I don't know, but I'm going to tell them that." I said, "That's exactly what I'm going to tell them." I had my... So he looked at the papers. He says, "Here. The head of it done. Iman, we call him."
Mm-hmm.
"You know, Paul. When do you want him out? Tell him we did... I'll bring the papers." I said, "Okay, I'll bring the papers. You come back." I said, "I'll bring the papers." The sheriff has to be there. He stays outside, hands me the papers, and I said, "I'll take it from there." The law required that you serve the papers, not that you as an individual walk in there. We're serving the papers. Here, the sign. Done, legally. I'll be to tell sheriff to tell the pitches. I'll talk to him later if you need to. Tell John, I'll tell my boss that the papers are done, and it's all done. Just 15 mm-hmm. minutes and it's over. After I talked with him first, I went down first and ate breakfast and so forth and told him we'd be back tomorrow morning. And said, "Yeah, no problem." I went back and had my breakfast again and ate. And we 2 hours there, and I was gone. "Hey, brother, talk to you later." As a result of that, what I was looking for, the sheriff of Los Angeles
mm-hmm.
wrote my boss, John Bugs, a letter to thank him for having me to do what I did. And you got to read it. And it says, "Because of what I did, I probably prevented a riot from occurring in Los Angeles that would probably have killed many people."
Oh,
I meant to
goodness.
Run it today. And I said, he says, "Carol, what's wrong with you, man? You everywhere you go, you get these kinds of letters. Who are you? I don't know." I said, "John, I just do what I do. I'm not affected by all this other stuff. It doesn't affect me."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Look, if he's a criminal, he's a criminal, but he's a human being. It ain't no big deal."
Right.
And I said, "I just went in, John, and did my work and so forth." He says, "You did more than that, because look what Pitcher says. This is sheriff now.
Mm-hmm.
Signed by the sheriff." I got to bring you that, though. You got to see that. I thought I had it in here, but I don't.
Oh, okay.
So that was in the first part of 60. That was the last part of 63, I think.
So after your work with the commission, what did you do?
Came to send... Oh. In the summer of 64, In 62 and 63, the South was beginning to explode.
Okay.
In 63, there was word we'd have, you've heard it perhaps, there was word that we'd have a hot summer.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard that.
Yes.
Hot summer. And hot spots here and the hot spots there. And the word was that the city should gear up and anticipate a hot summer. Okay. Well, two of the things that already happened in the South and so forth. Well, the Freedom Riders and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Going on. In 1963, I'll skip a few things in here because we can fill these in. In 1963, all the major cities were gearing up for a possible hot summer.
Okay.
San Diego does not have a problem at all. We are the epitome of democracy, and we don't have a problem. City Hall debated the media, all of the powers that be in San Diego. We don't have any problem, race problem. That was 63. In 63, do you know what CORE is?
Yes.
CORE had been active here. Harold Brown.
Racial equality. What is it?
Racial equality. CORE had been in the East and all that. Everybody knew what CORE was. So mm-hmm. they decided to organize a chapter of CORE in San Diego. You need to meet these people too, incidentally. I'm in contact with all those who still live, CORE.
Okay.
So.
Who are they?
Harold Brown is one. Ambrose Brodus is another.
Ambrose
Brodus. I'll give the whole list of them, still here.
Okay.
Peggy Finch. And several others. I'll give the whole list.
Give me, okay.
You can get interviews with them. CORE had organized in San Diego young people, since the older ones all these years didn't think San Diego had a problem. Now the young blacks knew they did. And many of the other black people in San Diego knew they did. And knew that they were just sweeping it under the rug. And they knew that we'd be no different from other cities if the word got out.
Mm-hmm.
So in September of 63, around September of 63, in looking at what had happened in the South, and looking at what had happened with the brothers and the men, had the four, the three young men had not been killed yet in the South. Sherman.
Goodman,
Cheney. Sherman and all that. But wait a minute now. I don't want to get the dates mixed up. In 63, CORE had organized and been doing that picketing in 63.
In San Diego?
In San Diego.
Okay.
CORE was picketing. And picketing the...
what were they picketing? Employment?
Employment agencies. Yeah. San Diego Gas and Electric. Bank, couple of banks,
mm-hmm.
and city schools, and a few other public businesses downtown. That was CORE. That was in 63. Let's see. 63, around 64. That's right. So, and they picketed. One of the ones they picketed. Yeah. One of the ones they picketed into their toilets in buckets and emptied the buckets on the street over their heads.
What?
63.
Buckets from the toilets?
All the stuff you can imagine. Put it out on the streets. Got it? 63. Let's see if it's gone. So the city decided maybe they did have a problem. But that ain't no problem. We solve it. So what they did, the year, let me see if I'm getting my dates mixed up. At 64. No, what happened? You know what happened in 64. Yeah. So in 63, they said, maybe we do have a problem, but we can solve this problem. The city, through the powers that be, put out word that they would organize a volunteer group of blacks and browns and the fathers that be, the power group in San Diego. They would bring together a volunteer group of citizens across the whole spectrum to handle these problems. And they did. And they appointed a young lady, white, by the name of Mary Phelan, P-H-E-L-A-N, as the liaison to a group that got to be known Citizens Interracial Committee. That's CIC, as we began to be known for the rest of, even till now.
Citizens
Interracial Committee.
Interracial.
City.
Interracial.
Okay. Committee Incorporated. Okay. And they assigned her as the liaison from the city manager's office.
Mary Phelan.
And gave them a little budget for, like, this secretarial stuff and so forth, for meetings and, for coffee and stuff like that. And they organized as a volunteer group to handle the problems that did not exist, racial problems that did not exist in San Diego. You got it now?
I got it.
Okay, now I keep the sequence here. That was in 63. Yeah. As a result of the pot stuff. We move around through September, October, November, and December.
Now, during all these, the racial unrest or the picketing here through CORE, were you still up in the L.A. area?
I was still with the, I was on the commission.
And that's how you knew about what was going on here?
Yeah.
Because of
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet. Because we didn't have a problem. City, we didn't have a problem.
But we did have a problem, right?
Are you being facetious? We didn't have a problem.
Oh, okay.
This was just an isolated incident.
Okay. Yeah.
Those niggas are bad out there. This core group of young, white, black, Hispanic, all of them. These young people, you know, they heard about what's on the news and they see it on the news every day. It'll just blow.
You're a great storyteller, by the way.
Thank you. So here we go. September, October, November. Yeah, they decided we did have a problem, but that's the way they were going to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll skip a couple of things. 264.
Okay.
The latter part of 63, a lot of stuff happened in the South. We can get that later on. But in the beginning of 64, those three guys got killed in Mississippi.
Right.
And we still didn't have a problem here. We have already organized a group of citizens, so we ain't worried about that. Skip, move forward. To February and all that. 64. They heard that all these cities around the country might explode. Might explode. So we better be sure that we've debated it in our city council enough and have money in reserve if something should happen. But ain't nothing going to happen. So the mayor, Mayor Kern, Frank Kern, decided to make a proposal to the city council anyway. Frank Kern was his name. That maybe in anticipating the long hot summer around the country, in Los Angeles, the big cities, and it's on the news, you know, everywhere it's going on, and Freedom Rises and all that. So maybe in anticipation of what may happen, maybe we do need to call in a professional group. And maybe we do need, to have some kind of professional group, if it's more than a person, look into our city here. Let me see, do I have another one of these? Look into our city. Today is the 13th?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Maybe we do need a professional guy instead of just Mayor Phelan, or maybe we need to have Mayor Phelan is still now the liaison. Beautiful young lady.
Now?
then.
Okay.
This is up to 64 now, beginning in 64.
Okay.
She's still the liaison of the Citizens Interracial Committee that was formed back in that September.
Okay.
September. Got it? Mm-hmm. That's Mary Feely. We're over to February and so forth.
Okay.
The city council, mayor makes a recommendation through the city manager, of course, that they should maybe hire a professional to head the Citizens Interracial Committee. But the proposal was to create a human relations agency or unit that worked out of the city hall, make it part of the city government. A human relations, by that name, human relations agency. The mayor made that recommendation. The city council says no, and we'll not call it a human relations agency because that implies we have problems.
Okay.
And we don't have no problems, so we're not going to even call it a human relations agency. January, February, March. Two different times he made the recommendation. The third time he... beginning of 64.
Okay.
Wait. Oh, did he? Yeah.
Okay.
All ready?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry. So the city council objected to it. We don't have any problem, but we might have some problems. But this group we appointed and we're paying this little lady for, that's sufficient. We're not going to hire. He says, but we might have, he made a proposal three times. The city council rejected it three times. He got wise as a politician. He says, okay. We're going to have some problems here if the other cities have problems. I don't know why they think we don't have any problems. Our cities or our counties live in different places, the different black people, the colored people, the Negroes in one way, the Mexicans, the Mexican-Americans in another. We might have some problems. And I'm trying to get this council to understand that. He got wise as a politician. He says, okay, in told the city manager, we'll do it a different way. Write up a proposal to fund CIC, the Citizens Interracial Committee, as a professional group, and we'll get a director and make that our, he told the manager, we're going to make that our human relations agency, but we can't say that. The proposal to the city manager, to the city council, would be in anticipation of hot summers and so forth, that we feel that we probably do need a pro to direct the volunteer citizens group. They have to write it up and all this political stuff. The manager did that. That's the way the manager did it. And they approved then his proposal to make the CIC the official human relations agency, because if you said human relations agency, again, they would reject it.
Right. Okay.
I give the mayor credit for that. So that's what they did. Now the next question is, how are they going to do it? He told the manager, work it out, Mr. Manager, the way that you know it has to be worked out. The manager was smart. He says, L.A. County is a premier human relations agency in the whole country. And we understand that they have sent many, many people. People go to them all the time for directors.
Mm-hmm.
Call them up and see what it is. Do you need a director? Say, yeah. Again, don't call it human relations agency. A director to human relations under the aegis of Citizens Interracial Committee. He says, okay, I'll do that. The manager was on board. He understood this.
Mm-hmm.
Because that city council was never going to approve anything that said human relations. So they called up John Bugs, as many had done. And John says, okay, we got another one of those calls. We'd already got calls from Syracuse and other places to send people, either staff persons or directors. We got another call. You ever been to San Diego? I said, yeah, me and my wife have run down because we lived with her sister. I said, we've been through San Diego a few times going to Tijuana. They seem to be having some problems, but as I understand it, they have they went through this.
Mm-hmm.
Volunteer group, and they want a director of human relations for that group. I thought of sending you down, and we always sent two people together, a black and white or a black Hispanic mm-hmm. or white Hispanic.
Okay.
So he says, I thought maybe you and John was my friend, ought to go down there and we'll set up an appointment. I said, okay, why don't we? So we called John in, and he said, why don't you go down? And the way we worked, it didn't matter whether they chose a black or white, depending upon the nature of the city in the first place. If it were primarily a white community, we'd send, they would choose a white.
Mm-hmm.
That was Walter, my friend. One or two little cities had growing Hispanic. They didn't call them Mexican American, then Hispanic
right.
and all. And we sent to Gutierrez, to a town in Texas. I don't think it was Houston. Anyway, depends.
Mm-hmm.
So black and white came here, me and
like
Walter.
Like El Paso or something like that.
Yeah. So Walter and I came down. And it was already either way, it didn't matter. So we came down the first day, and they interviewed us and sent us around the town and so forth. And we went back and told John, it wouldn't matter which one of us go. The black community is about like this, like we had
like
researched.
A
thumbnail. Yeah, I said, we had researched it. I said, the paper you gave me, probably pretty right, John, because they had sent us a paper, mm-hmm. ethnic group. I said, for black, look like 2%, or Hispanic like 4% proportionally. And I said, white everywhere, John. White everywhere. He said, why don't you two go down then? And I said, it's all right, whoever they choose. And so we came down Monday morning, whatever it was, Tuesday morning. Came down, they interviewed us, done it. The City Hall then was the old county building here.
Okay.
That was City Hall then. They didn't have the City Hall like it is now. So we went down, interviewed, we went back, we had dinner, went back. And I said, you know, I don't think it's going to matter here. I have a hunch, though, Walter, that the unrest is primarily in the black and Hispanic community, as they said. But in a deep way, Walter, the unrest is really in the white community. They're scared to death. But they don't know that. As he says, yeah, you know, we deny problems all the time.
What were they scared of? The black community?
Yeah, the typical, I mean, the city was afraid. The fathers that be, the citizens of Point Loma, La Jolla, over there where we live now in Valencia Park mm-hmm. and Emerald Hills, that was all white. I'll talk about that later on. All white over there. They're scared what the niggas are going to do, what the black people are going to do. What in quotes every night is the Negroes or so-and-so. I said, yeah, Walter,
okay.
that was the atmosphere. And I said, I don't think it's going to matter if Walter got it or I got it, because that, for all practical purposes, he's as black as I am and I'm as white as he is, because that's what we operate on.
Mm-hmm.
That was the whole staff. It didn't matter with us. So he says, I don't know, maybe... let's take a ride, and they gave us, we had the map. I said, let's take a ride through downtown. We did. We came through downtown. We asked a couple of people on the board, where do the black people live? Where do Hispanic people live? They told us. But we didn't have time to explore it much. So we went back and said, John.
Because you were new to the area.
New to the area. Didn't know anything about
right.
the area. And neither did Walter. We just came down for the interview.
Right.
And we told John what we thought and what we found. And I said, John.
And you were both interviewing for the director of the CIC?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And it didn't matter to us.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't. Because we'd done the same thing before. We've worked together in many, many, not as directors, but as joint. So we said, John, we had the interview. We do think they have some problems. They're really hiding them. They're really trying to cover them up. But eventually it's going to explode there. Now, they don't have anything like Watts and all this where black people constitute a majority and so forth. It's about like this for the black people. You can hardly see them. As we went down the streets, we could hardly see a black person. But they're scared, John, and so forth. He says, okay, we'll wait to see who they choose. They call us back and says, come back for an interview. No problem with us, John and I, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we came back. They did a second interview, and we went back and says, John, about the same thing. They had, this time we asked them for figures and so forth. They gave us some demographics this time. I said, Walter, going back, I said, I don't know about this. Black people are invisible. I said, they're completely invisible. He says, they sure are. Where do they live? And I said, I don't know, John, but we need to find out. So we left early and wrote a couple of places, and we had one of the members who interviewed us. Show us where the Hispanics live. Show us where the black people live. Where's this border? Mm-hmm. We'd only come down and gone, fool us, you know, my wife and I and my son. And I said, I don't know, but there's something strange about this city, Walter. He says, it sure is. And with the urgency that they're moving, we have a hunch that that is more possibly explosive than they think. And I said, I need to talk to some brothers. And he says, yeah, we sure do, but we don't have time today. Mm-hmm. I said, we'll just wait and see what it is, Walter, because if you get it, I'll come down and work with you. And if I get it, you just come on down. We'll put the staff together. We got word 2 days later, they chose me. I said, Walter, they chose me. So we'll work it together. And he says, all right. I came down on the week before Labor Day on September 7th of 1964, the day after Labor Day. I opened my office at 520 E Street. It was called the famous Robinson Building. That was on the 7th of September 1964.
Robinson. Okay.
Robinson Building. In the middle of downtown.
Okay.
Fifth Avenue. Now, the rest, you read about it for the rest of your life. It was, my office was not quite this big to the cot over there. Mm-hmm. I'll say from the second chair, on this end of the second chair, to maybe out where you are, we shoot to that second, that third drawer over there, mm-hmm. Whatever you call it,
right?
That third drawer. Mm-hmm. So yeah, from there out to across there, yeah. We say, wait a minute, no, that from the second, yeah, not this chair. From that, yeah, where you, yeah, straight out to that second, that third drawer.
Okay.
Right, straight down through there, right. Where you're pointing?
Uh-huh.
Right, straight. That was one, what, one, two, to the end of that third, yeah. That's about that big. It was big enough for a chair, and where the cot is would be a cabinet, mm-hmm. be a cabinet there, and my desk would, let's see, a cabinet. No, let's say that would be my desk. A cabinet would be on that side, but here.
Mm-hmm.
Another desk is going to be put in over on this side for the secretary later on, and that was my office. And then, as you will read later on, they call that from the dumps went to the city dumps and got me stuff. It was really the city storage, but it was
okay.
It was
right.
Really city dumps. No bigger than that.
Mm-hmm.
That may be stretching a little, so a desk could get in there. Not this kind of desk. Just a little desk.
Desk
and a table. Al Caldillo was my assistant, and a cabinet.
Who's your assistant?
Yeah, later on I chose him, Al Caldillo, Hispanic guy.
Oh, okay.
He stayed with me the whole time. He was beautiful.
How to spell his last name?
C-A-U-D-I-L-L-O, Caldillo.
Okay.
Caldillo, yeah.
Okay.
Let's see if I'm stretching it there. Let's see to the third one. Let me walk around in this room. Yeah, we had to be careful to open the door to get in for the first time. We moved after 4 months to a bigger office, but that's about where it started. They didn't expect
Remember
us to do
Remember the mic is on.
Didn't expect us to do anything. Mm. Went to the dumps, to the stores, literally. And people wrote all about it. It's, all the stuff you read about it, it's in there joking many times.
Mm-hmm.
There were three reporters assigned to us totally. That's all they did later on when we got the programs going. And they wrote about it. There's many jokes about the place
about
where
how small the office.
Yeah, and they didn't expect us to do a thing. September then the 7th, I opened the office in that place. It overlooked E Street because it went in from E Street. It's almost on the corner of E and E Street and 5th.
Okay.
520 E Street. That's where we stayed until 68. But let me see, Pina. I picked up that 64. Now we drive the point home in 64. They opened my office. And the reason they did it then was because of the killings in Mississippi of the three college students. And because the reports on all the news was they expected a long, hot summer. This is a year, this is 64.
Mm-hmm.
So beginning in September of 64, we began the long journey of running CIC.
Okay.
And from then on, as we say, everything is history. We upset the town, upset the city. We did it all. This is why we got so much written about CIC. From that time around to 60, that's 64. We missed another thing in 64. Oh, I told you because the buckets of crap over there.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's see what else. Yeah. They charged them. They charged core members and gave the men time in jail. They did not...
Because of the incident of throwing the other people throwing the buckets.
They charged the core members and never charged a single person for doing it, nor indicted any of the companies. Now, we have deliberately... Now, I guess we could do it now. We've deliberately stayed away from which company it was, deliberately, in this town. But we decided last year we're going to start calling names. The company never was indicted. The judge dismissed all charges against the company and found the men, found Coe guilty, and gave them a year in jail, the men, not the women, for picketing and all the, whatever you want to call it, trespassing. The irony of all this is even worse. The irony is CORE was made up of whites and blacks and all that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the famous members of CORE was named John. John was an attorney, a civil rights attorney here.
Was
ACLU,
he
white. Married to a black woman. We'll give you all the names. He looked at that case along with two or three other attorneys in town, and we'll talk about them because without these, the famous Carlin, what the Carlin case is?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. They met in my office, that's all my stuff. Carlin is all my stuff. Everything you're going to hear is literally my stuff, and I started it. They met in my office, the Carlin case.
Oh, okay.
And all the other cases, everything that happened for the next 5 years in civil rights was around my office. John went to, he says, you know, I was not there, I was practicing when they went down. But this town is racist and they're going to throw the book at you. Let me know what they do. They sentenced him to jail. And he says, they don't care in this town. I'll handle your case. I'll get a team of lawyers to handle your case. I'll hit it. So what he did was went to the judge and says, Judge, come on. Everybody knew John.
Mm-hmm.
John Porter was his name, attorney. Says, look, these young men, they're in the prime of their lives. They got kids. They don't need to be in jail, you know. They don't have any job. They're going to go on welfare. Look, you don't need to do that, Judge. We need to find some way. They met over a few hours, and the judge, and he says, look, my recommendation is let them serve their time on the weekends in jail, not prison, in jail, and come home at 5 o'clock on Friday, eat, meet with their family, and then go down to the county jail on the weekend so they serve that time. The judge says, I'll buy that. So the men serve their time, engineers and the whole bit, great, great group, as you'll know, meet. They served their time in jail on the weekends. On Sundays at a time, they were allowed to go home and be with the families. I'm going to say 5 o'clock, but that's their day at the time. Go home and be with their families and report back to the jail by 12 o'clock that night, or whatever the time was they gave them, that night.
So they were in jail from Friday to Sunday.
Do they serve that time out? Some of it's cut. You know, they got all kinds of breaks in between.
Right. Approximately how much, you remember how many months or weeks?
No, but I got it. They'll tell you.
Okay, okay.
I just, when I talk to Ambrose, we're friends, you get a chance to meet them all.
Okay.
I just want to know, they'll tell you about all the details. I have it all written up, but they'll tell you the details, how long they were in there, and people knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a side to this I'll bring up in a second. That was Core. They picketed, and Core got mm-hmm. indictment. This was in 1964.
Okay.
Now, wait a minute, did I say 64? Yeah, this
yeah,
is, 64. This has occurred in, for the Core people, it was in 64. That's good enough. One of the side issues involved in this was that the people who were driving this were part of the City Fathers.
Okay.
Big names, like any other thing. You don't lock up the mayor. You don't lock up the police chief. You don't lock up so and so. Part of the problem was that the blacks from the 40s had not got organized. I'll talk about that. Maybe not today, but I'll talk about that. And because they had not got organized, the youth didn't see any blacks taking any lead to do anything. There were two or three black ministers who had enough gumption to stand up to the white. And there were independent black professionals, the famous Kimbrough. I don't know whether you know who
mm-hmm.
Kimbrough was.
I've heard of him.
Yeah, he's the first black
Dentist.
Dennis.
Right. Right.
I'll be meeting with his family next week down here.
Oh, really?
They're in Los Angeles right now. He was a dentist, and he didn't like it. He organized the NAACP. Well, he was the second organizer of the NAACP in San Diego. He was the second one. And another one by the name of Dr. Carey, C-E-R-E-Y.
Howard?
No, not Howard.
Oh, okay.
Before Howard, yeah, before Howard. Howard was my buddy.
Okay.
Yeah. But this was 20 years before Howard,
okay.
Howard came here. And there were two or three other black professionals. Now and then we need their names. Now just tell who they are if we need them.
Okay.
Kimbrough had tried to get the blacks organized and said, we don't have to take this shit, she said. We just don't have to take it. Why don't we get organized and do something about it? The NAACP, then as now, has the label of being a social club.
Hmm.
Then and now. Kimbrough organized them to try to do something about it. Kimbrough was a one-man army picketing downtown on the major streets where nobody else would. He was independent. He could tell them where to go and what to kiss. He was independent. He did that until he got the attention of the media. Two or three others did that, independent. Rather than to try to organize what I'm getting to, the ministers and the others who didn't see any problems or were scared to death, and we'll talk about that another time. He says, I don't have to worry about them. I don't get my money from them. I make my money from the black people and so forth. And so did two or three others. A couple of ministers also said, I get my money from the congregation. I don't need to be afraid. But their congregations were. The black churches were mice, we call them.
Mm.
Scared to death.
Okay.
Core, as young people, looked around and says, we don't have any great fathers who would take the lead. We went to several of these ministers, and they would not do anything about it. That's why our core decided to do something about it. The side of this is there were two or three ministers who would have spoken out, but there was a major minister still in this town who had come to this town a little earlier than that, who was the spokesman for all the black people, end quote, spokesman. The model, we'll call, is the model they use in the South all the time. The white people knew John Doe out there. He's the spokesman,
mm-hmm.
and he does a talking for them. And what we tell John to do, he goes back and tells them. court looked around and says, we got one who will speak out. One black minister who will speak out. But because of the nature of the dynamics then, these other black ministers, only one, decided they would not speak out either. Because they knew that the fathers-to-be were going to call this other black minister, still in town and still a permanent one. They knew the white fathers were going to call him to give them a message. And that he was going to go back and do. Now, sure, he learned his lesson over the years, so I need to get that later on. Yes. But the core members being young, they didn't buy that. That's why they decided to take it in their own hands and organize their own pickets back then, back at the few months earlier that I was talking
right.
about. And when they got the stuff thrown all over them, they knew that the whites were safe. They knew that the whites were safe. They knew that the blacks were not going to come out against so-and-so. So they didn't have to worry about it. That's why John, being white, he says, we're going to do something about it. We're not going to stand by and let these young black men and women go to prison.
Right.
But the ministers, only one, stood up there. He died a few years after he was on my board at first.
Mm-hmm.
He had the gumption to also stand up later on and say, we need to do something about it. But this other black minister, permanent minister in town, had now the ear of the white fathers at B, and it was he who the young people blamed for what happened to them. And I think they are 1,001% right.
Wow.
And later on I'll tell you who it is so you don't so it can be said now. Being in the position I was, I said, you know, I like you, these young men,
mm-hmm.
these young people. I like you. And a couple of times, since I got here, I got core here. I was just wondering. Yeah, I got core here. When the city fathers wanted to pursue them some more and go to trial, they said, no, you have a group here, CIC. Why don't you? That's what they do. Let them handle it. Not these other individuals. No, let them handle it. By this time, we had built a reputation that
okay.
we didn't care whether they... fathers or police, whatever, we were going to call it shut as it was. And they had already trusted us.
Right.
That year then, they served their time, picking up, they served their time. And they got out. By that time, I pick up...
Do you have an idea about how many they were and how about what the age range was of the core members who were convicted?
Yeah, the age we say from 24 to 30.
So real young 30, men.
24.
I mean, young people.
Yeah, you somewhere on younger than that. I'll give you the whole roster. You can
okay.
talk to them. Yeah.
Okay.
The age, I'm saying, maybe from 24, well, maybe one or two were 35.
Okay.
But typically the young people
mm-hmm.
who were not afraid of anything, they saw some wrongs and they went after them. So the close for the day, I guess, if unless you have more time. CIC then was in the middle of this when we came. I heard about it. They had already done their thing. We picked up where they were, where court was. And the reason they didn't want us to do it is because we were telling them they were wrong. City and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so we began our long journey being the CIC and all the stuff that we did on the CIC.
Okay.
During that time. Let me see anything else. Just this chapter. CIC. 64. Oh, yeah. I need to mention one thing there.
Okay.
Today. We opened ours on September the 7th in 1964. That's when we opened the office. It's a crazy office. Al and I decided that we needed to, what we couldn't do when we came down from Los Angeles, we need to get a survey of the community. Let's check out this stuff. The incredible thing is two things. We decided since we overlooked East Street, busy street in San Diego, he and I decided when we take nights, in short, the whole thing was we want to look out our window 24 hours a day. We'd alternate.
So downtown was predominantly white.
Busy. Oh, some nights we would not see a single black person. That's why I set it up. Sometimes in the day we would see one black person. Other chapter, we're going to talk about all this later on.
Okay.
We would see one black person in the whole day on the streets. A white woman fell as we were going to lunch one day off the curb. Little old lady with the cane and so forth. And I reached down to pick her up. She says, "Get your black hands off of me, nigga." I said, "Thank you, madam, I will." We were to look at some time or other, we had our schedule. Al, I'll take the night between 9 and 12, and you come in tomorrow night between 9 and 12. And then tomorrow night you take between 12 and 3. We went to midnight every night. And that's what we did. We kept copious notes. Some nights we did not see a single black person downtown. We got the scope of it up. And I said, we need to also include now.
Was that what the purpose of the survey was, to see how many people frequented downtown?
To get a layout of the whole thing.
Okay.
How many blacks would be downtown? How many were visible? Because we knew they didn't have blacks in hotels.
Okay.
They had no blacks in hotels.
Yeah, I was reading that in your book.
Yeah.
So it was, you weren't, at this point, it was just blacks that you were concerned, not Hispanics, not
Asians.
Yeah,
that's what I'd like to say. Al, look, I'm looking at all of them. Let's include about how many
okay.
we see.
Okay.
We'd see more Hispanics because they were servants.
Mm.
They did that part. A few blocks down were the famous blacks.
So blacks weren't even housekeepers at the hotels or anything at that point? No cooks, no...
None.
Oh.
I opened up all that. None. No black, one black cab driver. I don't know whether I mentioned that book, but in other books it is. One black cab driver in the history of the Yellow Cab Company. One black.
Mm.
At that time, they had the famous black hotels you've heard about,
mm-hmm.
black hotels. Well, I'm writing up, well, you need to know that history. We're doing that right now. The Douglas, the Claremont, C-L-E-R, Claremont Coast Hotel, Claremont Coast. Well, you need to know all that history. We bring that in later.
Okay.
Hotel. Black people four blocks away on a famous shoeshine store, and it was not demeaning.
Right.
He was honored when he died a few years ago. He was a great guy, black guy, educated. The hotels that you probably heard of, you need to read that whole history.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Part of the hotel, a part of the Black Historical Society. So to end this part of it, we did our survey by watching at night, as well in the daytime. Sometimes we would go a whole day and see no black during the day downtown. So we began to say, wait a minute, Al, we need to do our survey. We began to take surveys. No black in any hotels, and I'll talk about that later on. Restaurants, couldn't eat in the restaurants, none. And we had try on and move on. That is, the department stores, if you tried on something, you either bought it or you moved on, had to wear it out. So I coined the term try on and move on. If you try it on, you keep it on.
Because they felt no one else would want to.
That's right. It was dirty.
Oh, my goodness.
It was dirty. I happen to know the first black woman. Wait, let's see. How long have you been in San Diego?
Only about 25 years, maybe 30.
Okay.
We said 1984.
Okay. 84. Was that Walker Scott department store downtown when you came?
If it was, it closed shortly after. I remember hearing of Walker Scott, and we have some of the things in special collections.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
He was on my board, white, liberal.
Hmm.
Labels didn't refer to, didn't match him. No labels much, except human being, period.
That's wonderful.
He was one of the few on my board. He didn't care whether it was the mayor or the governor. Scott was just a great man, his family. He owned the Walker department store. Barbara is her name, black sister, was the first black woman to be hired in a department store here, and she was hired by Walker Scott.
Oh, okay.
They did not have a black teller in the banks when I came. We go through that later on.
Okay.
We desegregated all that stuff in my office.
Oh.
Every black person that
CIC.
CIC did all this. For the next 5 years, CIC was involved in every single thing that dealt with race. Everything. Literally. From desegregating the schools, started in my office, to the housing, we'll talk about later on. CIC did all of that. To get in the first bank teller, she's still alive.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we need to talk to her.
Yeah.
All these people, most of these people, half of them are still alive. We desegregated the schools, the lawsuit, the famous Carlin lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
Changed the housing, changed the pattern of eating, all the hotels and motels. I was discriminated against myself in two ways in housing, so I had to threaten a lawsuit with the housing, and I was, I have a famous case on me that they wouldn't serve me in a restaurant, so it's okay, good enough, we'll sue you. But we'll do it through the media. We'll do it through the media. So we did it through the media, and much of it, Cora was right. Nobody had ever said to them, you've got to change it. The owner of that restaurant in the valley, they wouldn't feed me. Fired the waitress in front of everybody else that night. That night, fired the waitress. The typical thing was, I don't talk to the manager, my buddy and I. I had called my white friend down here, and he didn't know I was here. I said, hey, John, let's meet. Let's have dinner. He says, okay, here's where we meet. We met. Lollygagging and BSing the first hour. It didn't occur to us, all they put in was water and I said, John, we haven't ordered, man. He said, we sure haven't let's order. Call the waitress over. She came over and said she can't serve us. He said, what do you mean? It's not closing yet, no. But we can't close because we don't serve colored people here. I said, I don't blame you. We don't eat colored people here either. John was getting mad. I said, John, cool it, baby. I said, cool it, John. Let me handle this. I said, I'm used to this. That's why I'm in town. He said, that's why you're in town. They don't know. I said, John, cool it, baby. Just cool it. I said,
And John was white.
Oh, John was white. Great guy. Well, obviously, he was a great guy. I said, well, you know, what did you call the manager? The manager's not here. Oh, okay. Where's the manager? Well, he's gone for the night. Good. I said, well, we'll sit here either till the manager comes or the police. Whichever one comes first. You can call the manager up and see if you can get him on the phone, or we'll call the police. We'll just sit here all night if necessary. Of course, I said, John, don't worry. She'll find the manager. He's somewhere, you know. 20 minutes later or so, she comes by. I got a hold of the manager by accident. I've got all that stuff. I got a hold of the manager. I said, okay. How long will it be? Well, he'll be here. He said he's on his way. I told him we had a little problem. The manager came in. He says, what is the problem? He says, what? She wouldn't serve you here? She says, yeah, you don't serve colored people here. He said, who said that? He called her. Are you the one? Yes. Well, we never serve colored people in here, so I assume that we didn't do it. He says, we don't discriminate against anybody in this restaurant. We serve them if they're colored or white or opaque. We don't care. We serve everybody. How did you get the notion? He fired her on the spot in front of everybody. Oh. On front of everybody. And he says, we're glad to have your business. One reason we don't have, perhaps she thought so, black people just don't, colored people, just, we're not here. They don't come in here. Now and then, maybe one.
Right.
That's probably why. So, though... she probably...
So it wasn't the restaurant's policy. It was just she wasn't aware that it was open.
Others didn't know.
Oh, okay.
It never come up there.
You know? Okay.
And because it had not, and because San Diego was noted to be segregated and so forth, she probably assumed like it was in the south end of the place. They didn't serve. There was no... From a standpoint of just common sense, there's probably no reason why for her to believe that they did serve blacks.
Mm-hmm.
But he found on the spot to make the point. And he says, so we went through this thing, got served. He says, I'm glad you're here. We wish we had more, in quotes, colored people to come in here. He says, this is good.
The manager said this.
Manager, he's white, of course, mm-hmm. talking to us. And he says, you don't have to file a lawsuit. Yeah, unless you just want to. I will give you a year of free eating, you and your family, and anybody that you send in here. I'm going to give you an identification card. Have them bring this card when they come in here. It's a free meal as many times as you want, and your family, and the people you send in here to eat. I'd like to meet some of them.
What?
He says, I'm glad you're here.
What year was this approximately?
This was in 64 now.
64.
Wait a minute. I came in. This was the early part of, must have been 65, the early part of 65.
Okay.
Well, it hadn't been here too long because I took time, the 3 or 4 months I was talking about to get. So it must have been, it was 65. But I handled other cases. This mm-hmm. is just my case.
Right.
This is my case. 65. And he kept his word.
Mm-hmm.
He kept his word. I sent a couple of the black women from the social groups here, mm-hmm. you know, from the Lynx and whoever it was. Oh, Thelma went. Thelma, she died. She was the first one out, and she took her friend. Let me see, who did she take? She took Francis. We tested him out. He stood up with his word. He
said, what was the back. Name of the restaurant? Do you remember?
Yeah, I haven't called any names. But
okay. That's fine.
But it's in the paper. He said, so you head in the group? I said, yeah. He says, well, as you say, you can put it in the paper, the media. I said, I'll hold it out of the media until we know you for truth. And John, my friend, died maybe 15 years ago. Yeah. And he kept his word. He's a beautiful guy, beautiful man. And he says, we're glad to have you. As a result of that one, we didn't put in the news that I was discriminated against, but we began to put in the news blacks should go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
The policies changed. The stores downtown. We use the media, and then you would see all this stuff here, the media.
Okay.
But that happened. That happened in San Diego. Now, it was just as bad because the catamaran, you ever heard of the catamaran?
Yes, sir.
From back in the old days, the catamaran hired all black men in their suits and stuff. That was just as bad as the white restaurants hiring all whites, as far as we were concerned. If it's a restaurant, it should be open and not just blacks hired. And it was controlled from the slavery days.
Mm-hmm.
The black man wore the tuxedo and so forth. You know, the outside of the catamaran were these black stands that you have the black men.
That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, you know, they would see it. All black waiters. So I met him. And I said, hey, brother, you people own this? Well, no, this is a famous catamaran and so forth. Well, in the back of my head, I'm turning already. No wonder that the blacks don't hire. The whites don't hire. You have a black restaurant, a white restaurant, but all black waiters? My God, why don't you have white waiters here and black over there and so forth? So we opened all that up, too.
So it was sort of there, reverse
discrimination. This is bad. Us, yeah. It was just as bad. It was worse than when we get to talking about downtown hotel,
mm-hmm.
Where we desegregated as far as women are concerned. Geraldine Rickman and I, we went into the famous Grand Hotel there,
yeah.
And they wouldn't serve women. It's a place set aside like now talk about like this.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the men came to do their business every day. That's where the business is, a business club. There's a room over there. Got special treatment every day at noon. And I said, what is this crap? We'd heard about it. And I said, Geraldine, we got to do it. She said, yeah, let's do it. But it's going to be in a natural way one day. When we want to go have lunch, we're going to go in there. If they don't serve it, we're going to close it down right there. We did it.
Mm.
She just sat there. I said, she can sit there as long as you need to be. But she's a business partner. Yeah, we list her as a business partner and so forth. So she's a business. I said, I don't care if this is a business partner or a prostitute. She don't care either. Call her whatever you want to. We serve. We did that. We did that two or three restaurants. We changed all this stuff. Everything you see and hear in the next, for the next 10 years dealing with race, it came through our office. The research in 80, from the San Diego State students, they did research on CIC. It's all here and everywhere. You might,
okay,
somewhere in here you'll see that the name CIC was in the news more than any other group had ever been, and that my name has appeared in the media, in the press, more than any other single individual in the history of San Diego. That's because we had three regular reporters from the Union Trib that covered everything. You haven't heard the most of it yet. They covered everything we did.
Okay.
Every paper in the county covered us every day.
You had three reporters from a newspaper whose assignment was exclusively to cover CIC.
Yeah.
They
covered other things.
Right.
They had to cover CIC.
Right.
Yeah. You see, let's see, I call you one name right now. One was named Bryson, and we're doing a search now. I just turned any article in here. This one was by Frank. See here? I just turned right here. I'm going to give you one of these two.
Okay.
Just flip the page and see who it's by.
Rick Exaros.
Yeah. Who is that?
Ken
one?
Rhodes. I wonder if it's related to me.
Yeah. That's Rhodes.
Oh, wow.
What's the name on that?
Herbert Lockwood.
Right. Lockwood? Good.
Herb Lawrence.
Yep. But they're not the ones who were assigned there. Who's that one?
Oh.
Frank again.
Frank
again.
Mm-hmm. Ken Rhodes again.
Right.
Herb Lawrence again.
Right.
Now these were white writers.
All of them.
Dick Weber.
Yep.
John Wood.
John Wood's a great guy. Great guy. He was there whether he was supposed to be assigned or not. John Wood covered everything. Is that John Wood again?
Mm-hmm. John Wood again. Another side of the story is told in black communities.
Oh, yeah. It's.
Oh. Was he from this area?
Yeah. He has to be assigned to us.
Carolina. He asked?
Yeah, he loved us so much he hung out with us. Same names?
Sarah Congdon?
Yeah, Sarah Congdon was beautiful. She was simply great.
Earl Davis Jr.
That's black, yeah. That's Earl Davis Jr.
Oh, then we get into voice and viewpoint.
Yeah.
Ray Schwartz.
Yeah, Ray Schwartz. He was not assigned to us, but he covered us.
There's a voice from the voice viewpoint.
Yeah.
James Gilliam.
Yeah, he died. He was a brother.
Was he the judge?
No, he was not.
I thought it was Earl.
Yeah.
Dale Wood.
Yep.
No, Dale Hood.
Dale Hood there.
Dale Hood. You smoked a pipe?
I didn't smoke it. I only use it for two reasons. Yeah, two reasons. I'm allergic to smoke in the first place, but I also wonder. I had learned at being a psychologist some way to keep the tension down while it's going on every day. So if I play with the pipe and so forth, and my friend, one of my staffers said, "Use a pipe. You look good with a pipe and so forth." So I said, "No, yay!" And that's why the pipe is there.
Okay.
There it is again. Yeah.
Yep. A reporter's view of the Design for Understanding program. Manny Cruz.
Oh, Manny Cruz. Manny Cruz is. More would be written. You read about Manny Cruz in detail, that is, in detail.
Okay.
And John Wood. Manny Cruz is great. Now, we're in the process now doing the research to see if some of these reporters are still alive.
Hmm. It would be interesting to get their take on.
Oh, yeah. Well, all this, they've covered everything in there.
Okay.
Everything is covered. I mean, they wrote those articles while it was going on.
Okay. So your makeup, your staff was?
At least 40% Hispanic or other all the time, from day one. From day one.
Okay. Well, we can stop here and pick it up later. So yeah. I know that we stopped at the, well, I have my notes.
Yeah. Never notes that. And
so we're into 1960.
But we're still, let's see, we are not out of 1964, but we've covered some things.
Right.
Some things.
So we can.
And then we can get a systematic way now of this. What happened in 64, 65, 66, 67, 68, 69, 70. And this is a whole CIC story here.
Okay.
One of the stories.
I guess. Do you want me to keep that?
Yeah, no, let's see. You can have, let's
okay.
see.
Okay, fantastic.
See, let's see if we can have this one, I think. So. Let's see. This one, this is a copy I found out here. Well, let me see. I've been looking for this.
This concludes this. First part of the interview with Dr. Carol Wayman on January the 13th, 2011 at San Diego State University Club Room.